evening. Wonderful, wonderful, beautiful weather out there right now, but tomorrow is not going to be so kind to central Pennsylvania. We're going to get a whole pile of snow. If you've run to the grocery store to get water and eggs and milk and stuff, I saw somewhere 6 to 8 inches of snow tomorrow. Oh, my goodness. Maybe that's why Rick Smith took the night off. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick. It's Friday night. He generally takes Friday nights off so he can be with his family. Getting the car packed, packing the swimsuits and the shorts and all the fun warm weather gear. He's taking off down to Florida with the kids, and Santa Claus will have to head on down there to find them. But we are getting some weather. Weather coming tomorrow. And then headed straight up to New England for later on Sunday, and they're expecting quite a big in New England from this storm. So, the old saying, if you don't have to go out, don't go out. Enjoy it at home. Go outside. Make a snowman with the kids, or make a snowman by yourself. It doesn't have to be a kid activity. Nice snow angels. Good stuff. It'll be fun. It's always beautiful to see snow before Christmas, before the holidays really get into full swing. And then afterwards, it's like, forget it. Bring spring on already. We don't want any more of this snow. I love snow, but I'm happy with it for about 6 weeks. Then I want to keep moving south, though, for my attitude. I don't want global climate change to be bringing me warm weather. That's not the plan. Anyway, if you've got thoughts tonight, we want to hear them. 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. You can check out the website, too, of course, ricksmithshow.com. Go check that out. See our lineup of guests. We've got some really fun stuff going on tonight. I love it because pretty much every night I'm on, so is Professor Susan Feiner. She'll be joining us tonight. We've got our hands full with this budget and what that might mean, the new Paul Ryan. Anything with Paul Ryan's name on it, I just think includes pain for people who can't fight back. Pretty darn certain of that it's just going to be painful. But we'll find out. We'll find out what Susan thinks. Professor Susan Feiner, she is a professor of women's studies and economics. We've got Ed Buttlespaw on. He is the outgoing DCA, Downtown Carlisle Association president. I love Ed. He is a wonderful person. He helps everybody who asks for help. I have never seen someone go to Ed and say, we got this nut to crack, and him not just jump to the help, even to the point of when I was working with the homeless and I said, I've got a lady in the shelter who doesn't have a coat, and said, here's my credit card, go buy her a coat. Had a woman who had a job interview, a homeless woman who had a job interview in Philadelphia. Ed got her a vehicle so that she could go to Philadelphia for the job interview. You know, for those of you who know the distance between Carlisle and Philadelphia, it's not really around the block. He's just a fabulous guy. He's done wonderful work for the entire Cumberland County area by being the head of the Downtown Carlisle Association, because every little ripple, of course, moves on out. And he's a big Corvette fan. So he's spearheaded that whole Corvette show and so many other shows and parades that happen downtown and are tied in with Carlisle events. So Ed's going to be here. We are also going to speak to Chad Bruce. Chad Bruce is the founder and director of the Charles Bruce Foundation, and the Charles Bruce Foundation is a private foundation that will be a public 501c3 as soon as the IRS gets back to them, which with that IRS scandal could be just about anything. Oh, they don't like certain. No, they're going to be fine, I'm certain. Anyway, Chad and I and a wonderful woman, Mary Ann Parks, got together and wrote a children's book this year, and that book is coming out. The book will be launched on Monday at CALC, the Carlisle Arts and Learning Center, and Chad's going to come on over the station and talk to us about it and tell us what we have to look forward to. Anyway, we're going to talk about all kinds of, interesting things that are going on throughout Pennsylvania, the rest of the country. But first, I mean, pretty somber news today. There just seems to be no limit to the number of shootings. That tomorrow, of course, the anniversary of the Sandy Hook killings, 20 first and second graders and 6 adults. The anniversary is tomorrow. We're going to have somebody on the show that's going to chat with us about, you know, what this means and why on earth are we still stumbling over the notion of some sort of gun control, background checks, whatever's necessary. 90-something percent of America wants it. The other, however many percent, are in Congress. But another shooting today in Colorado, and it's got to be painful. Poor Colorado. I mean, this school where the shooting happened today was Just a couple of miles from Columbine and just a few miles further than that from the Aurora movieplex shooting. I mean, Colorado reeling from the pain of what's going on there. And why is this happening in the United States of America and not other places? I mean, you can count on one hand the number of times, I think, in my lifetime that I can remember someone talking about this sort of a mass craziness. There was the Toronto shooting not too much before the Aurora, Colorado movieplex shooting a couple of years back. But really, that's the only Canadian one I can think of. What's going on? You know, what is the story in the United States of America? And, you know, is our inability to stop our representatives from listening to people like the NRA what's causing this sort of carnage? Not to mention the one or two kids that die on the street in gang-related or inner-city-related just violence. Staggering. Staggering. Anyway, we're going to get to that. And I don't know if you heard about it, but it was just a couple of days ago on December 9th. An unarmed college student at the University of the Incarnate Word in Texas was killed by a campus police officer. So here's a campus police officer shot and killed this unarmed student, 23-year-old communications arts major Robert Cameron Reedus, pulled over for allegedly driving recklessly, according to police, after a quote-unquote struggle took place. The officer, Christopher Carter, fired six shots. The incident took place at an apartment complex not far from the school. One of the witnesses said that she didn't hear him say anything like, get down on your knees, didn't hear him say anything to the young man that was killed, just started shooting. It's upsetting. You send your kids off to school and you think they're going to be safe, or you send your family member off to teach at a school and you think that things are going to be kind of sane. The university says that Carter had an extensive law enforcement background before he went to work for the school, but documents published by the San Antonio Express News show that he worked for the Texas University for 2.5 years after holding 9 different jobs at 8 different law enforcement agencies. How do you have 9 jobs at 8 law enforcement? Well, I guess one guy moved, one place moved him around a little bit. Anyway, I don't know. And they want to blame it all on mental health issues, but there are a lot more people with mental health issues who don't do this sort of thing. I mean, there are people with mental health issues who do violent crimes, and it's an awful thing, and we could head that off at the pass by having adequate mental health care. But there are so many more people who struggle daily, some with medicine and some without, to overcome these just regular everyday illnesses, no different from a chicken pox. It's an illness that aren't violent and don't do these things and aren't harmful to themselves or someone else. And so, you know, it just becomes this catchphrase of, oh, well, it was a mental illness issue. And, you know, that's just not fair. Not fair at all. Anyway, we've got a big show coming up. I'm glad you're here. If you're home wrapping Christmas presents or doing whatever, we're glad to have you with us. If you want to weigh in, get your pen. The number is 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. We'd love to chat with you. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back. It's gonna take it, get that time. We want the world and we want it now. We're gonna take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. After an 8-year saga of first winning and then losing collective bargaining rights, graduate student employees at NYU this week won a huge union victory. By an overwhelming pro-union vote of 98%, 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the United Auto Workers Union. NYU is the only private university in America with collective bargaining rights for graduate employees. Matt Canfield says an incredible effort was made for 8 years to sustain the solidarity and cohesion that led to this resounding union win.
It took a constant education. You know, and it's difficult in graduate employee situations because there's just constant turnover. And so what it really led to is educating so many employees about how to organize. And we did that over the last 8 years. We've just had a wave after wave of really remarkable organizers coming from across the university.
Canfield says NYU's graduate employees are excited about building on this successful union vote.
This has been an eight-year-long struggle with 98% of victory. We are just looking forward to bargaining now. We're excited to get into bargaining negotiations, and we're also looking forward to hearing from our colleagues at other private universities who are starting to call for union representation as well.
UAW represents more than 45,000 academic workers across the U.S., including graduate employees at the University of Massachusetts, University of Washington, University of California, and California State University. Nearly 800 nurses and healthcare techs locked out at L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut since November 30th say that it's not about money. The healthcare workers are concerned about the well-being of patients as the hospital continues to outsource patient care to non-union locations outside the hospital. Lisa Dabroska is president of the AFT Registered Nurses Local at L&M.
It's about being able to follow our patients and take care of our patients no matter where they are located. We just want to be able to go along and continue to care for our patients like we have been for the last 101 years.
Dabroska says the corporate model, reducing everything to numbers, doesn't work in healthcare.
We are not dealing with numbers. We are not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with patients. And what it seems is the corporation running this hospital is treating the patients like numbers and like widgets. And we just want them to treat the patients like a patient, like a human being.
Patrick Hickey of Madison, Wisconsin's Workers' Rights Center says this year's local Just Dining Guide had two Madison restaurants with perfect scores in how they treat their workers.
Ian's Pizza and Restaurant Muramoto that got perfect scores. What we rank them on are things like starting wage rates for tip to non-tip, access to health insurance, access to paid sick days, access to retirement, access to other kinds of paid time off like vacations and holidays. Things like that. These jobs really do need to provide living wage and decent family supporting benefits because our economy needs that. Most of the jobs that are getting created are these service jobs.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center publishes their own national version of a Just Dining Guide at rockunited.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door, this holds the throne. Heaven looking for the map that leads me home. I've been stumbling on cold hearts turned to stone. The road of good intentions is gone dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
It's a beautiful evening. We're all hunkering down, getting ready for the snow that's going to come and be a lot of fun. 4 to 6 to 8 to 7,000 inches tomorrow. All the numbers, you know, the numbers just seem to get bigger and bigger as you count how many eggs you've got left in the fridge. But it's going to be nice. It's going to be pretty, and it's the holiday season. Everybody loves to see the snow fall. You know, we're in the professional tomato throwing business, and it's always so nice to interview someone that just deserves a whole pile of pats on the back and accolades and love, and that's Ed Bidlespa. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, Patty. How are you?
Oh, great. Of course, Rick Smith's off for the night. You know, he's headed down to Florida to flee the snow, I think, next week, so he's getting ready for that. You are the outgoing president of the DCA. What is that, a two-year term?
Well, it was, yes. I had a two-year term as president this past year, the year before. It's usually just a one-year term, but I guess either they felt sorry for me or they just couldn't find anybody else.
Or they've got the same Pat LaMarche feeling for you, and it's like, wow, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. This guy's fabulous.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what it was. So what is the DCA? Is that a not-for-profit? I mean, it's the Downtown Carlisle Association, of course, but what is it?
Downtown Carlisle Association, it is a non-profit organization. An organization that is put together and an organization to benefit the downtown to kind of preserve and revitalize the downtowns. As you know, so many of our downtowns, because of the big box stores and the shopping centers and the big outside of town things, are really suffering because mm-hmm. they're losing their draw for the downtown, there's a number of reasons why people say parking. People say they don't like to be out in the weather. I mean, any number of reasons, but the downtowns over the past couple decades have really suffered. And Downtown Carlisle Association has been put together to try to revitalize and stimulate the downtown Carlisle.
Yeah, I mean, everything from, I mean, obviously, I love Carlisle. It's one of my favorite places on earth, and I've been in a lot of places. And it's historically significant. It's beautiful. It's got flowers hanging from pretty much everything. And then there are all these little vital shops, like you're saying, vital, vibrant shops that where you can actually go downtown and, oh, by the way, get soda or eggs or milk or a stick of gum or a birthday gift or things that you can't do in a downtown in most places anymore.
Yes, and we're very actively, we have a retail recruiter that is actively pursuing little niche shops, if you will, looking for the little finite items that people can't just find in the big box stores. We have several in downtown, in our downtown, as you know, on Pomfret Street. Mm-hmm. There's several little shops on Pomfret Street that are just fabulous little shops, and they're springing up all over our downtown. We have a lot of different stores on Hanover Street and restaurants galore. I mean, I don't think there's any type of cuisine you could want that you couldn't find in downtown Carlisle.
Right. You know, just around the corner, I do live on Pomfret Street, and just around the corner from where I live, a new wine shop has opened.
Yeah, we have. That's kind of really cool. It's the Castle Rig over there. Mm-hmm. Alan opened that here just recently. He went there for wine tasting, and he carries couple different brands of wine and has wine tasting in there, all kinds of little tchotchkes, if you will, for your wine, little carrying cases and bottle stoppers and cheese and all the good things. It's really a cool little place to go for just an afternoon to sit down and have a nice glass of wine and relax.
Yeah, and I was chatting with him because we have a function at Calc on Monday night, and we're going to get the wines from him for that event. And he's putting in, like, especially because of the holiday season in which he started his business, he's putting in 80 or 90 hours a week as an independent small business person. When your retail recruiter's out there, is it hard to find those people who literally just want to turn their lives over to small-time retailers? Is that getting harder and harder to find?
Well, those people have a passion for what they do.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, my job is to go out and talk to people about their business, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that all you have to do is open the door and they want to just talk about what they do because they're passionate about it. So to answer your question, there are people out there that don't even think about that. It's their passion. It's their life. It's what they want to do. And they just do it. They don't really consider how much time it takes. I mean, it's just a way of life for them.
And they get to be their own boss. I think that must be kind of, I don't know if my boss is listening. But
which one?
Yeah, really. But getting to be your own boss is going to be kind of a nifty, neat thing to do, even if it is the fact that you have to, you know, you're your own boss, but you're also your own employee. And if nobody shows up, you better be there. You know, all that extra work that comes from being the owner of the business.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of self-satisfaction that you get by being your own boss. I was in that position for several years myself, and you're right. I mean, there's some satisfaction to know that your decisions are yours, and good ones, bad ones, or otherwise, whatever they are, you learn to live with them. You can't just say, well, that's a corporate decision. It's yours, you know. So
yeah.
If it works, okay, good. If it doesn't work, okay, we won't do that again.
Right.
That type of thing. But it's fun to be able to do that and be able to kind of find your own direction to go and see if it's going to work or not. But it's a lot of challenge, it's scary sometimes. Let me tell you, sometimes you just don't know, especially in a small business. You just don't know if it's going to work or not, but you have to just hang in there and try.
Right. It is interesting, too, to talk to the folks on Pomfret Street, especially, but also in the other up on High Street and Hanover, about how they work cooperatively together. Obviously, they have the DCA to lean on, but three or four businesses will get together and buy an ad or something like that, and they really are working together in a fashion that you just big box stores either just don't need to or they wouldn't, you know. You don't very often hear that the cinema is going to promote, you know, TJ Maxx. You know, it's not that same sort of camaraderie that you get from these small business people who all are each other's neighbors at the same time.
Well, that's right. And they do pitch in and help one another. I mean, we have several different, as I said earlier, different restaurants downtown that pitch in together. And when there's an event in downtown, as you well know, the Downtown Carlisle Association does all kinds of different events and promotions to try to entice people to come downtown, and they work together to promote that, whether it be with free giveaways or prizes or whatever. They try to work together and try to promote the same thing and try to promote it townwide. So whatever they're doing on Pomfret Street, they're going to try to do on South Hanover Street or West High Street or whatever, so mm-hmm. that it all works.
Now, some things have changed over the years, and, for example, First Friday, which is one of the things that goes on, that's become a monthly event all year long instead of just the warm months. How is that going?
Well, actually, it was I was one of the guys that said, I don't know if that's going to work or not, but you know what? It has worked, and they've changed the format a little bit. Originally, it was like they used to do North Hanover Street, and then the next month they would do South Hanover Street. Then the next month they would do Pomfret Street, and the next month they would do High Street. Well, we've changed it up to, as you said, we do it all year long, every month, first Friday of every month, and we now do it townwide. So every month the entire town works together to promote First Friday to bring people downtown. So we have something going on. And if you look, every First Friday, we try to promote something. I think I remember right, we had a breast cancer coalition. We sponsored one time. We had Project Share. We did the Salvation Army, that Carlisle New Year's, the Heart Association, Child Abuse. We do an art walk in May, I believe. We had a kids' night in June. They do summer fair in July, and I think they had a music walk or something like that, music and wine or something like that in September. So every month there's a theme that they try to promote.
And all the shops are all in on that theme and do this. I definitely, the breast cancer one was striking because there were signs, and I think absolutely every single store shop window all through town.
Yeah, and they do. They all get together. We at the DCA have several different committees, as you know, and one of the committees that's responsible for these events is the promotions committee. And the promotion committee works together with all the merchants downtown, the stakeholders, and the residents in the borough to try to come up with a theme for that week, and they all work together to promote it. And like you said, we all get together, and they stay open that Friday night, longer hours, and do the things that you have to do to be there and be what people want to come downtown for.
Now, if it's if the Downtown Carlisle Association is a not-for-profit, how does it get its funding?
We rely a lot on the events we do. We do several different money-making events. Some of you, I'm sure you're familiar with the Corvette Parade, for example.
Oh, yeah. You guys make money on that.
Yeah, we charge. We work together with Carlisle Productions out at the fairground, mm-hmm. and they let us set up a booth out there, and then we sell spaces or sell spots in the Corvette Parade for people to bring their cars downtown, show them off, and ride through town. The Ford Parade, the same thing. And those people pay to be in those parades, and that brings, I don't know, probably 20,000 people downtown on a Saturday night, you know, in the summertime when they're having the Corvette Parade. I know when I started, when I took over as president of the DCA in 2000, at the end of 2011, we had participation of about 358 cars, 350 cars in the Corvette parade. This past past August, the end of August, we had the Corvette parade. We had 455.
Wow.
We maxed out. We could not take any more because we have to be able to let traffic through. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to let the emergency vehicles get through, so we can only accommodate so many cars in town because the streets are closed. So we maxed out. We started the Ford parade in 2011, which was my first year as president. And we started out with 240 cars, and this past year we had 350, and that's growing every year.
Wow.
There's talk about doing another one for Chrysler. I don't know if that's going to happen this year or not, but there's talk about doing one for the Chrysler show. And that we do the Harvest of the Arts, which I think you're familiar with, Harvest mm-hmm. of the Arts, where we have the closed down the basically the whole Hanover Street or High Street area, and bring in artists and juried artists and all kinds of things. And we kind of put that together with the Welcome Jam for the Army War College.
Mm-hmm.
That brings in, and also we tie it into the Homecoming and also Parents Weekend for Dickinson College. So we try to schedule it with Parents and Homecoming Weekend for Dickinson and the Penn State Dickinson School of Law. That event alone brings like 20,000 people into the downtown that weekend.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's a lot of people downtown, and it takes a lot of effort. We have about 80 volunteers, and the labor is all volunteer labor, so the people that help us out don't get paid for that. They do it because they want to see the downtown survive.
Yeah, and those things are so much fun.
They are. They're a lot of fun. It's just a great time. It's a great social atmosphere. It's just fun.
Yeah. Now, you know, I've watched you work on an awful lot of these projects, and, you know, you're on an awful lot of boards around town, so a lot of people know Ed Bidlespire from F&M Trust. And the thing I think I'm most struck by, as I sing your praises on a regular basis, is the fact that you don't get cranky. I mean, at least not to anybody I've ever seen.
What's the point in getting cranky?
Sometimes you can't help yourself. Is that no one's going to believe me on that line, huh?
Well, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. So, yeah. You know.
It is amazing, though. You don't feel the stress of having 455 cars coming into town and 20,000 people?
No, I look forward to it. I think it's great. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's just fun. I remember not too long ago, somebody told me they never saw the Corvette parade, but they sat up in their apartment and looked out their window and saw all these cars coming down the street. And I think I saw a picture of their feet.
That was great. And it was the perfect vantage point having an apartment up on Hanover Street. And I looked out and I thought, what? All those cars look exactly alike, which I know makes anyone with a Corvette cringe. I'm like, hey, dudes, you all got the same car. But I did. I went and grabbed a glass of wine, and I put my feet out the window, and I thought, this is heaven. I love this town.
Yeah, it's fun. It is. There's a lot of things going on. And last night at our annual dinner, we had the general commandant from the U.S. Army War College, and I was really impressed to hear him sing the praises of downtown Carlisle and the way people – the local people actually treat the students and the visitors that come to the War College. And I mean, it's a great place. And he couldn't say enough good about Carlisle and the way the people are treated here. In fact, what struck me a little bit last night was there's a guy came over a year ago from, I don't know, one of those countries over there that we don't really like to talk too much about, but somewhere over there.
Uh-huh.
The only thing he knows about the United States is the 1 year that he spent in Carlisle.
Huh.
So he is basing his entire opinion on the people and country of what he found here in Carlisle for that time he was here at school. So that's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Right, and that's pretty wonderful for the rest of the country that they're all getting whitewashed with that same image. Yeah.
Fortunately for us, we're doing it right.
Yeah. Now, Ed, I got like 90 seconds left. Tell us real quick about your replacement. Who's coming in?
My replacement's going to be Mike Curley. Mike Curley is Director of Transportation for Carl Area School District. Mike's been involved with the DCA for a long time. He's been instrumental in the Corvette Parade. He's helped me a lot with the Ford Parade. Mike's going to be a tremendous asset, I think, for the Downtown Carlisle Association. John Thompson has the printed image at print shop here in Carlisle.
Oh, yeah.
He's coming in as our vice president. And he's actually in charge. He's the chairman of the promotions committee downtown. So he's been real active this past year in making things happen, coming up with some different ideas and energizing the promotions committee to keep things moving and get it done. And funny story with John, you know, he was part of the reason that I had to stay on as president for the second year. So I said to him the other night, I said, you know, it's get even time now. You're going to be vice president.
That's right. That's
payback.
Right.
Payback. Yeah.
That's right. It's a lovely lady, that payback. Ed Vital Spa, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for taking some time to chat with me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, and you have a wonderful evening. Love your show. Take care, and have a great time, and have a nice holiday.
You too. Thank you. That's Ed Vitalspa, one of those vice presidents over there at F&M Trust Bank, and also the outgoing president of the DCA, the Downtown Carlisle Association. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Right-wing political operatives deserve credit for inventiveness. In particular, they created the Rob defense for public officials who get caught engaging in bad personal behavior, such as sexual misconduct, snorting cocaine, and bribery. When nabbed in an act of naughtiness, the standard defense thrown out by politicians of all stripes has been to blame, quote, stress of overwork, and to apologize to anyone who is offended by their grossly offensive action. But that excuse is overused, so advisors to right-wing bad boys have invented a new defense, just claimed to have been in a drunken stupor at the time. So see, it really wasn't their fault. Blame the booze. The Rob defense is named for Rob Ford, the almost comically offensive mayor of Toronto, who keeps explaining that his crack cocaine use, abusive rages, and other antics only happen when he's sozzled, totally blotto. Recently, though, a Tea Party Congress critter from Florida added a clever refinement to the Rob. Arrested in November for buying cocaine, Representative Trey Radell dolefully confided in a press release that, quote, I struggle with the disease of alcoholism. That's a shrewd touch, for you get extra public sympathy if you're a victim of disease. But let's note that Trey also suffers from another disease he did not mention, political hypocrisyitis. Barely a month earlier, Radell had joined his Republican colleagues to bash poor people by voting to require mandatory drug tests for all welfare recipients. Did alcoholism make him do that, too? This is Jim Hightower saying, the poverty program pays under $200 a month for a family of four, while Radell draws more than $14,000 a month from us taxpayers. If Congress really wants to kick drug abusers off the public dole, its best odds of finding some would be to start testing its own members.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You know, they're not going to snuff out everybody's voice, and some people are really... By the way, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. It's a hectic night, running back and forth up the hallways, phones are ringing. Congratulations. Before we go any further and start talking about the doom and gloom, which is our reality in some parts of the country right now, I just want to congratulate the wonderful folks at WIOO who stepped up yesterday, had a radio-a-thon, and raised more than $5,000 for the local Salvation Army. Salvation Army's all across the nation issuing press releases that this year has been one of the most dismal for collections. Nobody's surprised. Nobody's got any money. The haves have got it all and they're not parting with it. And the have-nots are all trying to help each other, but they can't. And so WIOO stepped in, and boy, did they do a fabulous job. Hats off to Ray Thomas. Hats off to Mike Davis over at the Salvation Army. Did a radiothon yesterday and raised more than $5,000, so congratulations. But really, what is going on in this country? Our children are dying in their schools. And, you know, some folks just aren't taking it anymore. With me right now, Kristen Bruck. Did I get that right, Kristen?
Yes, you did.
Kristen Bruck, the one-year anniversary of Newtown is tomorrow, and there's another shooting in a school today?
Yes, we did hear about that.
My heart is breaking.
Oh, our hearts are broken, too. This is the 28th since Newtown. You know, the details are still emerging, but our thoughts are with the victims, their families, their community, every time this happens. I know they're still finding details about what happened today, but it just keeps happening.
Yeah. And so what is going on tomorrow? You moms who aren't taking it anymore. We're moms, and we're not taking any, but that's not the title of your organization.
But, no, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
That's better. You folks have three actions tomorrow here in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, we have three, yes. There's actually events all across the country. We're having events in Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Newtown, Pennsylvania tomorrow.
Wow, there's a Newtown, Pennsylvania.
There is.
Huh,
yeah.
That's kind of ironic, isn't it? So what are you going to be doing? And can regular everyday old people get involved? Can, you know, if they want to hop in their car and drive to one of these locations, can they just come and help?
Absolutely. The information for all of the events across the country are on our website, momsdemandaction.org. There's a list of all of the events and the times. Our first one tomorrow is in Pittsburgh at 9 o'clock at Chatham University. And then at 11 in Harrisburg at the Lutheran Church of God, and 2 o'clock in Newtown. 11 o'clock is in Newtown. 2 o'clock is at the Messiah Church in Harrisburg. But all of the details are on the website. We also have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/MomsDemandActionPA, mm-hmm. And that has the Pennsylvania event.
Okay, and people should go to that page, like that page, showing
right.
solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you can't, if you have to work tomorrow, it's everybody who's got a job is grateful to have it, and if you're in retail, you're probably not going to be able to make it. But it's something we should all be talking about. We should be talking about it today. We should be talking about it tomorrow for sure, and the next day. We shouldn't let this be a silent reality in this country. Are you folks the ones who are doing the new TV ads, too, that say
we
that...
We did just have a TV ad, yes, that was released last week.
Yeah.
The idea of our events is no more silence, that we keep having moments of silence for the victims, and it's time to end the silence and to keep this conversation going.
Now, is there a reason that you in particular are involved? Why did you become a mom demanding action?
Well, you know, on December 14th last year, mothers across America woke up to the national epidemic of gun violence, of what's going on in this country. And it really opened our eyes and made us realize that gun violence isn't a partisan issue. It's a public health crisis. And, you know, I'm a mom. I have two elementary school kids, and nothing's more important to me than the health of my children. And that's why our organization has grown so much. We have more than 120,000 members and a chapter in every state now.
Wow. And how does someone become a member?
All you have to do is go to our website, momsdemandaction.org, and you can click on the link to join us. And then at that point, we will give you a call, send you an email, and see what you're interested in doing. And, you know, we have events that happen throughout the year. We've done a lot of things. We've met with federal, state, and local officials. I never before this year met with my state representative or my federal representative. I've met with both of them. But we've done other things that, you know, if you're not interested in meeting specifically with your legislator, there's other little things you can do. We have a lot of tools on our website to be able to send a quick email or send a quick tweet and make your voice heard and not be silent anymore.
Yeah, that's pretty wonderful. That's interesting that you said you never spoke to your state senator before. It is interesting to see the issue that makes people or helps people understand that they are the government. You know, mm-hmm. and so you've got that issue that broke through and made you understand that they have to answer to you. You're the boss of them.
Right.
And it's exciting to think that out of such despair and such sadness, 125,000 moms have found their voices.
Right, and the thing is that I've now spoken with people who have been in this movement for a long time, and they said they've never seen the momentum continue for so long, and that's because moms are involved now. You know, moms have made changes in our society throughout time, and now that we are awake and we're paying attention, you know, we're not going away. Our children they're the most important thing to us, and we're going to keep at it. And you know, some parents say that gun reform isn't happening legislatively, but that's not a good enough against for us, and we're going to keep at it.
Do you ever hear from the bad guys? Do you ever hear, and by that I don't mean a guy who's got his gun. We all know that the guy who wants to either take off and do some hunting or do his, you know, guy thing or gal thing, you know, a lot of women do it, go out target practicing or whatever. You know, but do you ever hear from the people who insist we have to be able to email guns? We have to be able to have plastic guns that'll be hidden when you go on a plane. We have to be able to have AK-47s and M-16s and absolutely every sort of automatic, every kind of weapon. You know, those guys, the NRA shills. Do you ever hear from them?
We do. And, you know, one misconception about our organization is that we're anti-gun, and we are not anti-gun. We're just looking to have some safety measures put in place to protect our children, to protect society. And, you know, we are a new group. We are all coming together with different ideas, and we are willing to listen to, you know, what other solutions are out there. But at the same time, there are, you know, some common sense practices that need to be put into place. And I found that once I start having conversations with people who so will come out as very strongly, they realize that we are not anti-gun. We just want to make things more safe for everybody.
Right. You're anti the indiscriminate distribution of guns based on having enough money to buy one.
Yeah, well, we want to make sure that, you know, there's background checks on a gun sale before it happens. We want to make sure that there's limits on what, you know, ammunition and magazines. We just want to have those measures in place, not take away everybody's guns. We certainly are not in favor of that.
You know, I'm glad that you said that because we have an email here from Pam and Jean who are listening in Maryland, and they want to know why, if everybody they're talking to is cool with the idea of a background check. I mean, it's something like 90%, right?
Yeah.
Why is it so hard to get Congress to pass that?
Well, I think it's hard to get Congress to do anything right now. I don't think it's specific to guns. You know, I read that actually with the Manchin-Toomey bill this year that and in the House there were more votes on that than some previous bills. So there actually is it is moving. It just hasn't passed yet, just because of the way that Congress is running right now. And that's one of the reasons why we're going beyond Congress. And we had a very successful campaign with Starbucks this fall, where Starbucks came out and asked people not to open carry in their stores, which previously they had not said that. And so we're looking at other angles within society, not just legislatively. We do think that eventually, because of public opinion, that will pass, but we know that that's going to take time, so we're looking at other avenues as well.
Now, that was pretty remarkable, wasn't it? The guy who owns Starbucks, which, you know, you'd think that the NRA crowd would overlap pretty completely with the independent business owner sort of laissez-faire, I own my business, I'll do what I want in my, you know, if I don't want people to have purple sneakers, I'll tell no purple sneakers. Boy, he took a lot of flack, that Starbucks dude, when he said, yes, please don't open carry.
He did, and he, you know, they had not really gotten involved prior to this, but there were a lot of people open carrying there, and we said that we really weren't comfortable with that. That when we go to get our coffee, we don't want all of that, the weapons in the store unnecessarily. And it kind of came to the media front, and Starbucks came out and said, yes, you know, we don't want that in our store. And there was, you know, there were people that weren't happy with that, but we feel that that is a really important thing to continue with. And so now we're taking our campaign to Staples, with the same kind of thing, to ask them to do the same. And, you know, we're looking at other businesses as well.
You know, if you've ever run a copy, or you really know why someone wants their gun. Sorry. You know, I mean, what do you need a gun for in Staples?
Well, that's the question that we're asking, and that's really our whole concept, is that we are not against gun ownership. We definitely agree with the Second Amendment, but we believe that the Second Amendment has limits, just like the First Amendment does. And I don't see the need for having a gun with you when you're making copies.
Right, copies and coffee and anything else that people do in public discourse. Like, oh, math or spelling. I mean, that's the other thing. Still, there's not that much news out about this shooting today, but it seems like one of the people who was most seriously wounded was someone who was trying to stop the gun person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's such amazing heroism that's going on, you know, with unarmed people in these conflicts. It just...
Right. Well, there was even earlier this year a student that went into school, and someone was able to talk to him and get him to put the weapon down. And, you know, that's what we want to keep seeing happening. We want to see that the outreach within community and to make everything safer for our children.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm in my mid-30s.
Kristen Brooke, by the way. So, Kristen, how old are your children?
My daughter's in kindergarten and my son's in third grade.
Right. So you're young and your kids are young.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in school, because I'm in my 50s, right? When you were in school, was there any fear like this that, you know, somebody with a gun would come into your school?
I don't remember it, no.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. I know that the first that I remember was Columbine, because mm-hmm. that's when I was in college, and I was an education major. I was going to be a teacher, and I just remember the fear that I had that this is where we were going.
Yeah.
And now as a mom, I can't stand for that. I have to do something about it, and that's why I joined Moms Demand Action and why I'm going to continue to work with Moms Demand Action.
Now, does Moms Demand Action have non-mom allies? Like, can you join it if you're a dad or, you know?
Absolutely. We have a dad's chapter.
Okay. And then
we
people
also have
without...
a grandparents' chapter.
Yeah. And people without kids at all?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, you've got these three actions going on tomorrow. You've got the new ad coming out about Stop Being Silent. I don't know which organization had put it together, but have you seen the interviews or the 60-second pieces done by the parents of the children who died at Newtown?
I've seen a few videos, yeah. I'm not sure if they're the ones you're referring to, though.
Yeah, I don't know either. I should call them up so I can refer to them better. But I saw them today, you know, because I was preparing to interview you. And I don't know. You'd have to have absolutely no heart at all or soul or any other vital pieces to watch those 60-second clips of the parents talking about their dead children and think in any way that a background check would be a bad idea.
But, well, I don't. I think that, you know, you said before 90% of people aren't completely in favor of background checks. So, I mean, I think that even without that, it's just a common sense thing that we believe will eventually get passed, but we do need more people to speak up. We need the silent majority to stop being silent, and then this will happen.
Now, you said you spoke to your senator. How difficult was that?
It really was much easier than I thought. I was very nervous beforehand, but and it was actually my representative that I spoke to. He was very nice to talk to.
How did you get a hold of him? I'm doing this like here's get a hold of your legislator 101 for people who are listening so they can learn what you know now. How did you get a hold of it? Was it him?
Yeah, I just called and asked for an appointment. And I didn't know this before. They meet very regularly with their constituents, and they scheduled me in for when he was home during a recess. And I ended up speaking with him one-on-one for about an hour about all of this.
And
so
what did
he,
was he,
to make an appointment.
Was he sympathetic already?
He was. He and I didn't agree on everything, but he was very willing to listen to me, and we did agree on more things than I thought.
And do you mind if I ask his political party?
He's Republican.
Huh. And so you feel like maybe some headway was made? Have you seen the way he votes on these bills that come forward?
Yes, I think so. And, you know, one of the great things about Moms Demand Action is that we are nonpartisan. And that's really opened my eyes a lot, too, that, you know, gun violence is really not a partisan issue. And we have always thought of it that way, I think, as a society. And that needs to change, too, because it really isn't. And I think getting out there and talking and meeting with your representatives, that is really key to make everyone, we all kind of know it, but to make it very clear that this is not a partisan issue.
Yeah, and I think the biggest problem that people are learning now is people caring isn't partisan, and Congress people or senators or legislators or whomever needing campaign money is also not partisan. Both political parties take a boatload of campaign money from all kinds of special interests, and someday that special interest money comes back to roost. And so I think an awful lot of good people get elected who get elected, then they realize, uh-oh, you know, I'm not actually going to be able to do anything I want to right now. And if they don't get enough public pressure, if they don't have enough moms like you and dads like you and individuals and grandparents and everybody calling them, they don't have anything to go back on that special interest with. You know?
Right, and that's one of the great things with Moms in Action. Like I said, I never did this before. Mm-hmm. And the tools that Moms in Action provides, you know, first I started by sending an email, and then I started tweeting, and then they had his call tools as well, and it kind of worked me up to being able to go in and meet with him, and really, it really opened my eyes to that, and I appreciate all of the tools on the website that help make that so easy, because we are their bosses, and they do need to hear from us.
Right. And so will you be reaching out again? Is that your plan? You've got these actions, public actions going on, but is your plan then to double back down and reach back out to your elected officials? I mean, is that the goal of 125,000? That would be, I mean, if everybody got a call out of 125,000 people, I can't imagine that would be that easy to ignore.
Yes, actually, we had a week of action this week leading up to tomorrow, and so every day there was a different thing. One day was an email, one day was tweeting, and today was to call your representatives and your senators. And we will continue to do that. We will continue to do that until we feel that our children are safe.
Now, do you, as the Pennsylvania Moms Demand Action, do you feel like you can talk to your Pennsylvania legislators and get it changed on a state level first, or is this definitely going to have to be a federal issue?
I think it's both. We are focusing with the state with a specific bill, which is HB 1010, which would expand background checks. We have a great background check system in Pennsylvania, but there is a loophole. There's no background checks on long guns and private sales. So HB 1010 would strengthen that, would take away that loophole. And so that's one of our major focuses now, because we think, you know, that that's a very simple, common sense, realistic step to take. And we've been meeting with our state legislators about that bill.
Okay, so a private sale, that would be like, I have a gun and I'm going to sell it to you?
Right.
Now, how would I do a background check on you?
Right now you can just sell it without doing it. If you mm-hmm. wanted to go do a background check, I believe you would go, and then it could go through, you can go to either where the gun shows are, and they would do some kind of background check through the background check system.
Now, if somebody wanted to just do that themselves, like say we've got Joe Responsible Gun Owner out there, and he's hearing this and saying, mm-hmm. wow, you know, that's a good idea. I don't think I'll sell my gun without a background check. Can he go to the local police mm-hmm. department and do a check on someone who wants to buy the gun?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't know off the top of my head. I would imagine that if they didn't do it there, they could tell them where to mm-hmm. go to get that background check done, because from what I've been told, it only takes a few minutes to get a background check.
It's not expensive.
A major inconvenience.
Right. I wonder how expensive it is, and I suppose you'd have to have the other person's agreement. But if it's a friendly mm-hmm. sale and you want to buy my gun, and I say to you, you know, I'd love to sell it to you, but come on, let's go down to the police department together. I want a background check on you. And then all of a sudden you say to me, never mind. You know, I might have my answer. You know, if somebody's completely reluctant to get a background check because they want to do a private sale for me, maybe
right.
I know I don't want to sell to that guy. You know?
Right.
I mean, that's even just encouraging that level of responsibility for the next couple of months until we can get some stuff passed. You know, don't willy-nilly just sell. And a lot of these guns, I mean, I'm pretty certain the Newtown massacre was what it was. Every one of those guns was purchased legally.
Right, and you know, one of the arguments that I've heard is that some of, like with HB 1010, that it wouldn't have prevented Newtown, and we realize that, you know, we're very realistic. We know that you can't prevent every tragedy. You can prevent some, and as moms, that's all that matters. If I can prevent one tragedy by having some common sense solutions put into place, then I have to do that. I have to work towards that.
It strikes me, though, and nobody's saying that anyone could have undone that horrible tragedy, because that's just hurtful, too, you know, to tell people that have gone through all this pain for a year that, oh, well, it could have been avoided. But, mm-hmm. but it just strikes me that if we had a climate and a culture that really sort of frowned on a basement filled to the rafters with an arsenal, you know, if we had a culture that said, you know, not necessary. And, oh, by the way, the thing that drives me crazy is people say, you know, you can't take my gun away because I might need to stand up against my government. I'm like, you know that you're talking about the lady at Motor Vehicle. That has got to be the laziest form of patriotism I've ever heard of, that you want to keep your gun so your country will be safe. How about you vote, or you talk to your legislator like you have, Kristen, or you do something to become an involved citizen, not wait till the last minute and then have to shoot your government official. I mean, that's the justification for the Second Amendment. I need it in case, you know, of revolution. Really? You don't want to make sure that the library stays open till 11 by voting? You know? It blows my mind. People are just thinking they need their weapons because it's going to get that bad.
And we hear the argument a lot that we're against. People say that they feel that we're against the Second Amendment, and we aren't. We just think that there needs to be some limits on it.
Right. Well, Kristen, it's a real treat to chat with you. I appreciate what you're doing. I personally, as a mom and a mom of two teachers, you know, and you get worried when your kids go to school as the teachers too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for putting your time and energy into this because it is just so important to all of us.
It is. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Yeah. Kristen Bruck from Moms Demand Action. You can check them out at momsdemandaction.org. And Pam and Jean, who wrote in, there is a momsdemandaction.org in Maryland, so you can learn more about them, too. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith, and we'll be right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. After an 8-year saga of first winning and then losing collective bargaining rights, graduate student employees at NYU this week won a huge union victory. By an overwhelming pro-union vote of 98%, 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the United Auto Workers Union. NYU is the only private university in America with collective bargaining rights for graduate employees. Matt Canfield says an incredible effort was made for 8 years to sustain the solidarity and cohesion that led to this resounding union win.
It took a constant education. You know, and it's difficult in graduate employee situations because there's just constant turnover. And so what it really led to is educating so many employees about how to organize. And we did that over the last 8 years. We've just had a wave after wave of really remarkable organizers coming from across the university.
Canfield says NYU's graduate employees are excited about building on this successful union vote.
This has been an 8-year-long struggle with 98% of victory. We are just looking forward to bargaining now. We're excited to get into bargaining negotiations, and we're also looking forward to hearing from our colleagues at other private universities who are starting to call for union representation as well.
The UAW represents more than 45,000 academic workers across the U.S., including graduate employees at the University of Massachusetts, University of Washington, University of California, and California State University. Nearly 800 nurses and healthcare techs locked out at L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut since November 30th say that it's not about money. The healthcare workers are concerned about the well-being of patients as the hospital continues to outsource patient care to non-union locations outside the hospital. Lisa Dabroska is president of the AFT Registered Nurses Local at L&M.
It's about being able to follow our patients and take care of our patients no matter where they are located. We just want to be able to go along and continue to care for our patients like we have been for the last 101 years.
Dabroska says the corporate model, reducing everything to numbers, doesn't work in healthcare.
We are not dealing with numbers. We are not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with patients. And what it seems is the corporation running this hospital is treating the patients like numbers and like widgets. And we just want them to treat the patients like a patient, like a human being.
Patrick Hickey of Madison, Wisconsin's Workers' Rights Center says this year's local Just Dining Guide had two Madison restaurants with perfect scores in how they treat their workers.
EM Pizza and Restaurant Muramoto that got perfect scores. What we rank them on are things like starting wage rates for tip to non-tip, access to health insurance, access to paid sick days, access to retirement, access to other kinds of paid time off like vacations and holidays, things like that. These jobs really do need to provide living wage and decent family supporting benefits because our economy needs that. Most of the jobs that are getting created are these service jobs.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center publishes their own national version of a Just Dining Guide at rockunited.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Share my narrow point of view, please. I want you to love each other, care about each other, and stop being so darn cheap with somebody, some rich guy's money. That's my narrow point of view. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith, who has the night off. He's getting ready to head to Florida with the kids. They're all headed down there for the holidays, and that'll be a lot of fun. This is like the third or fourth year in a row that they've done it. They gave the kids a chance to not do it this year, and they were like, what, are you crazy? So they're all packing the swimsuits and getting ready to go and be Joe, Jane, and the Jets in America, spending the money to build the economy and to tell us whether or not that's going to work. My favorite, Professor Sue Feiner. Hey, Professor Feiner, how are you?
I'm doing great tonight, Pat. How? Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, Paul Ryan, the savior. We've got a budget.
Woohoo! There's not much in this budget that progressive leftists should be overjoyed about.
Even the Wall Street Journal didn't like it. What is that? Usually, that's a good sign.
Yeah, that I did not know that.
Their headline was best worst budget.
Well, I don't know what they're going on about. I have not read that. I'm particularly unhappy about the elimination of the long-term unemployment benefit.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got to plead ignorance on almost everything in this budget, so please just tell me what's in there.
Well, the piece that is most disturbing is that they have eliminated unemployment benefits for people who are unemployed for over, 26 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
They had an emergency extension of benefits out to about 90-something weeks.
Yeah, 99 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and they've eliminated that coverage from week 26 to 99.
Well, Senator Chucklehead, and there are so many that fall into that category, I don't distinguish between them anymore. But some senator this week said, I think it was the senator, it was Paul Rand.
Yes, he said that giving people all this unemployment benefits just made them not have a job. And instead of, no, it's because they don't have a job that they need the unemployment benefits.
Wasn't that spectacular?
Well, except that, why does it even get reported? The level of not understanding these things that allows politicians to say stuff like that. Mm. I mean, it's so laughable.
Well, you know,
I mean, what would it be if they came on, if one of these senators came on and said, yesterday's massive rainstorm was caused because the people put on their windshield wipers.
That is exactly what he was saying, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, you know, people would, this is what would happen in the United States of America. People would turn off their windshield wipers and they would say, well, I shut mine off. I bet the Simpsons left theirs on.
And that's why it's still raining.
Yeah. And they blame each other at the bottom of this dismal pyramid under which we're all being squished.
Well, I saw a wonderful picture, I guess you'd have to call it, that came across Facebook a couple of days ago. And it was that Fox News, :, rich people paying rich people to tell middle class people that poor people are the problem.
Exactly. And the best part of that sentence that you just told me was you said Fox News, :. How redundant can you get?
Oh, Pat.
That's the fullest :' I've ever seen right there.
Yes. It's time to get out the fiber all.
The whole station would have, the whole entire network would be gone. Cleaned like a good cleanse should. So we're losing the 99ers. The 99 is what they've been calling them, which is horrible because then they become the welfare recipients so that we can hate them on a different level.
Yeah, it's also, the situation in our in the job market is really quite grim. The official unemployment rate is 7%, which is down a couple of points from where it was about a year ago, but it's 10.9 million people. That's almost 11 million people.
Wow.
But there are an additional 7.7 million people who are working part-time because mm-hmm. they can't find a full-time job. So you've got 10, call it 11 million people plus 7 million people. That's 18 million people. And then there's another 6 million people who want jobs and are willing to work, but they've given up looking.
Yeah.
So we've got our 11 plus our 7 is 18 plus 6 is 24 million people.
Which, if I'm doing my math right, and everybody, including infants, could work, that means 6% of the entire population of the United States is out of work. And
well, it's 15% of the labor force.
Wow. Yeah, because we don't let infants work yet. They're trying in Maine.
They're trying in Maine.
So I do this. I have my page at the Huffington Post, right? And my post went up today. And one of the statistics I had for it, because I was talking about this dismal holiday season for families, in the last 5 years, incomes have gone down 7.5% and cost of living's gone up 7.
So that's a real cut of 14%.
Right. And so that's for the few poor slobs who still got a job.
Uh-huh.
You know? So we've got and Black Friday showed it. There were a lot of people in the stores, more people in the stores than they've had on record, but they spent less money. Less money per purchase and less purchases.
Right. But and that's an indicator, but we need to step back from that for a minute because even as an advocate of full employment, I am not an advocate of this hyper-consumerist economy that we live in.
Yeah, buying a bunch of crap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the reason people have jobs is so they can have income. Mm-hmm. And the reason they have income is so they can buy stuff. But we don't actually, if you were to survey people, and there are such surveys, people don't actually want all the stuff that's produced. Because, like you said, a lot of it is just a bunch of junk.
Right.
But you can't just the economy is so interconnected. You can't just fiddle with one thing over here and not expect it to have a lot of repercussions elsewhere.
I just like to have asparagus.
Asparagus.
We
would cut all the broccoli and
no,
Brussels
I didn't
sprouts.
Even try to buy broccoli or Brussels sprouts. I was just in the grocery store last week, and I picked up, you know, what, asparagus size of my wrist bundle, right? And $4.25. You know, if you're legitimately trying to only spend $60 or something on groceries, and you're gonna throw away, you know, what is that? Like 9% of it, 8% of it on one thing of asparagus.
You're not gonna eat asparagus.
Right. And so when you think about the luxury you could have if you had full unemployment, it might actually just be some food that's good for you.
Well, that would certainly be a wonderful thing. So full employment at decent jobs with decent working conditions, that should be the front and center goal of economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
Full employment, people who want to work should have jobs, and the federal government should be the employer of last resort. Anybody who wants a job should be able to sign up for some kind of federal jobs corps and get paid $25,000 a year for doing something.
Right.
And that would be a remarkable step forward.
Right.
And then you immediately hear this clamor from a lot of Democrats and from all the Republicans about the need for a balanced budget. which brings us back to this budget deal and the cutting the long-term unemployment benefit, which is being done in the name of, oh, we have to have a balanced budget. But there, that is utter nonsense.
So having debt isn't, now that's not the national debt, that's the budget being balanced. Can you explain the difference?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Let's just imagine that Pat LaMarche was Pat LaMarche earned $60,000 a year.
Yeah, let's imagine that.
Let's imagine that. Woohoo!
That, yeah.
And her total outstanding debt was $60,000.
Wow, I owe my entire income?
Yeah, but you owe it over 10 years.
And I
and you have a loan that's an interest-only loan.
Okay.
Okay?
So I'm only going to pay the interest on the $60,000 for 10
years.
You're
only going to pay the interest on the $60,000.
Okay.
And because you have been it's been determined that you're going to live for another 100 years.
Okay.
When we get out 9 years and 11 months from now, you go to the bank and you say, I need another $60,000. And I say, fine. And you get the new $60,000.
So now I owe $120,000?
No. Oh. You pay off the original $60,000.
Oh.
And you just keep paying interest. You just keep rolling the note.
I see.
You just keep rolling the note. And that is, in effect, what the United States has been doing since 1837. We have had a national debt. That $60,000 is Pat LaMarche's debt.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has had national debt since 1836. We got the national debt to zero. The economy crashed, and now we've had debt ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets bigger because, you know, the economy gets bigger and we fight these wars and we need a space program and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we borrow more. But the United States isn't going to die.
Right.
And so it's going to be here.
Yeah.
And so we borrow this money in 10-year, 20-year, 30-year increments. And when it comes due, we take out a new loan, pay off the old loan, and make interest-only payments. Now, people get hysterical about this because the numbers are really big.
Right.
$17 trillion. But go back to Pat LaMarche.
Mm-hmm.
If you're earning $60,000 a year and your whole entire debt is $60,000, is that really anything to worry about?
Well, and after I said, wow, I was thinking afterwards, if I had $60,000 income, it's very reasonable that I would buy a $100,000 house.
Yeah.
You know, which is more than I can make in a year.
Exactly.
Okay, so this helps sustain, and at a time like this, when we're now looking at a whole pile of people who can't find a job if their life depended on it, and I'm going to, you know, I have never struck another human being. I've never hit anyone. I never struck my children. I'm getting there. You know, if one more person talks about how they ought to go find a job.
Well, the number right now is I printed something off the internet. I confess before we came on the air because I wanted to have these numbers at my fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
There are 6.25 job wanters for each available job.
Wow!
So every time there's a job advertised in the newspapers, there are 6.25 people who potentially want that job.
Right, and even if that job is just plunging toilets.
Or flipping burgers,
right.
Or cash registering, or whatever it is.
Right, and yet the ALEC governors want to pour a whole new population from 12 to 16 years old into that job market.
Oh, yeah, it's good for them. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate of teens 16 to 19 years old is already 20.8%.
Now, I sent you something, I think I did, and I could have daydreamed it because I've been really crazy busy today and I keep thinking I've done things that I didn't actually do. Did I send you the Atlantic story about the Pope? The Atlantic Monthly story about the Pope.
Well, you've been sending me stuff about the Pope because I know that he's been talking about we need to have an economy that values people.
Right, and that he said that the grossly rich were basically guilty of murder.
That's right. He said this economy kills people.
Right.
Yes, you did send that
and
to me.
And he's got all this. Well, now the Atlantic has said that Pope Francis doesn't understand the economy, and he doesn't understand the reality, and blaming the greedy is out of line.
You know, it's funny that this is coming up now. In the early 17th century in France, there's something called The Fable of the Bees, and it's by Bernard Mandeville, and it's private virtues, public vices. And the idea is that in your private life, you should be, you know, thrifty and nice to people and magnanimous and generous and all that stuff. But if the public sector, if the public sphere behaves that way, the whole thing would go to hell in a handbasket. So that early as the 17th century, people have, in defense of capitalism, have been arguing that No. The economy has to be evaluated by an entirely different set of human and moral values than the human and moral values we hold each other to in our private relationship. And I just completely reject that because the economy is a creation of human beings. The economy is there to serve us. We create economic relationships, and we can change them. And we need to hold economic relationships to a humanistic standard. I mean, slavery isn't, among all the other things that it is, it's also an economic relationship.
Right.
It's forced labor.
Right.
Now, people are morally appalled at the concept of slavery,
right,
as they should be. So we don't get to argue that we can bring back slavery because it's tremendously profitable.
Well, except the fact that we all wink, wink, nudge, nudge tolerate Pakistan? A factory collapsing and killing...
Oh, in Bangladesh.
In Bangladesh, thank you. 1,127 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that's slavery. We know that people being forced to work in a place, and when they complain about the cracks in the building, are told to go back to their machine. We know that. And Rick and I and Brett, the producer who you chat with when we talk to you, we went out with little slips of paper to the stores where the goods are sold that came from the
uh-huh.
stores that wouldn't sign the agreement for worker safety.
Yeah, like L.L. Bean.
Well, I don't know. It was in Pennsylvania, so there wasn't an L.L. Bean. But we went to Macy's. We went to Target. We went to JCPenney. We went to Foot Locker. And we started handing out slips of paper that said 1,127 people died. And this store, and it listed all the stores, Walmart, would not sign on a $500,000 agreement. That's all it was. A $500 million, $500 million or something. I don't even remember. It was not enough money to even make these guys blink an eye. $500,000 it was. $500,000 they would have to buy in, and they wouldn't do it for worker safety. And we're telling, you know, the shoppers that who walk right by us and go in and shop. So, you know, you go zoink.
You do, and
I would say five out of 100 people turned around, but the vast majority. Oh, that's a horrible
just ignored
sentence.
You.
Yeah, one lady at Target said, "Well, at least I'm not buying clothes."
I remember, probably 8 years ago or so, when there was quite a lot more agitation around the living wage movement. Mm-hmm. There was at least one survey done, probably multiple, but the economics of it is something like this, that if people doing textile production in Mexico were paid living wages, then for each $20 that the product costs, you'd add somewhere between 5 and 10 cents to the cost, retail cost of the product.
Right.
So if it's a $20 shirt, it would cost $20.10. If it was a $40 shirt, it would cost $40.20,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah.
And so that's the estimated economic impact. And consumers were surveyed by a reputable survey outfit. I don't remember if it was Gallup or Pew, but one or the other. And overwhelmingly, consumers said, of course I'd pay $40.20 if I knew that the workers making the apparel were getting paid living wages.
And I think what happens is, at least in the, and maybe I'm too Pollyanna and I'm letting too many people off the hook, I think what happens is people say, well, somebody else has to do it. You know, I can't not go in Macy's, right, because my one not buying that handbag isn't going to change anything. Somebody has to make Macy's do it, which would be the Governmentment. Right?
Oh, that.
You know, I'm all for government. I wish we had one. You know,
I certainly wish that we had a government that acted in the interests of consumers and workers. That's for sure.
And so, but I think that's what people think. They think, oh, okay, I would do it. If they passed a law that said that it has to pay a living wage and it's going to cost me 20 more cents, I would go along with it. I think that's how people feel.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't think that they're the one who's going to actually make it happen.
Right, and they're not really sure that they should go stand on a street corner on a cold and blustery day to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, too, is that with the proliferation of these horrible, horrible jobs, people have to work 2, maybe 3 jobs. And so nobody has any time to do anything.
Right. And they certainly don't have a lot of the time to research where their purchase came from.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the Atlantic thing. I'm just going to read you a quick bit of it. And one of the things that irritates me about this apologist for the greedy that is writing this,
mm-hmm,
is he acts like this is needed. All right. He says that Pope Francis, without citing a single statistic, is appealing to our fears and pessimism, that unbridled capitalism has enriched a few but failed the poor. He says he doesn't have a single statistic. You know what? I can tell you right now that almost every single human being on this planet has 2 eyes. And I'm not going to waste my time getting statistics for it. And neither does the Pope need statistics to say the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. He's not talking
He's not writing economics articles.
But people
he's
know
pointing
it's
out
yeah.
the obvious
yeah.
and saying that it's morally wrong.
So this guy says he doesn't have any statistics like that. He's implying the Pope's wrong. But
yeah,
he doesn't
well,
use
that's
statistics
a, that's
to prove
pathetic.
The Pope wrong. I know. Where
Do you remember, probably in the 80s, there was a bishop's encyclical, and this was in response to Reaganism and how much accelerated poverty was in the United States and inequality, and the U.S. Council of Bishops came out with a statement, and they talked about housing as a right, and that the homelessness was terrible, and food, and that kind of thing. And it was very similar in tone and argument to what Pope Francis is saying today.
Yeah.
Well, and it got the same exact review.
Right. And the thing about this Pope is he's so charismatic that
that
I think this is the beginning of several shots you'll see fired across his bow. But so this is, again, from the Atlantic Weekly, and it refers to him by his real name instead of Pope Francis, which I think is another way of robbing
that
him of his power.
That is so crude.
Yeah. Unbridled, this is according to the Pope, unbridled capitalism has enriched a few and failed the poor. We have to remember that the majority of our contemporaries are barely living from day to day with dire consequences. A number of diseases are spreading. The hearts of many people are gripped by fear and desperation, even in the so-called rich countries. The joy of living frequently fades. Lack of respect for others and violence are on the rise, and inequality is increasingly evident. It is a struggle to live, and often to live with precious little dignity. And the Atlantic is taking exception with this, and the next line, the Atlantic prints, is just how free the free market really is today is debatable. And they go on with the fact that maybe if the free market were freer, things would really kind of ease up.
What contorted logic. Because things have deteriorated in the last 20 years, and what we've done in the last 20 years is take off many of the controls of the market. So deregulating the market has caused inequality to get worse. Deregulating the economy has wiped out hundreds of thousands of units of affordable housing,
mm-hmm.
and that's in the United States. But deregulating markets has had a huge and negative impact in the developing nations,
yeah.
because the deregulation has often meant in these countries that they've switched from subsistence agriculture, which would sustain a family,
mm-hmm.
to export-based agriculture. So now you're growing sugar cane, and mm-hmm. you can't eat the sugar cane. You have to sell it.
And that's what the British did to the Irish in the 1600s.
And in India,
yeah.
and in the Philippines,
yeah.
and in Brazil, and they're called banana republics for a reason.
Right.
You plant a plantation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Professor Feiner, we're now like 4 minutes past when I was supposed to let you go, and I didn't even notice because I have so much fun talking to you.
Yeah, it is a blast.
So you'll be I'm riding the boards, as they say, again Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, and so we'll have you on 10 o'clock Tuesday and Wednesday of next week also.
Sounds like a plan.
Wonderful. It's so much fun, and you really, I mean, explaining these things like how simply you explained, you know, the whole debt issue. That's what we need, so that these phrases that get thrown out by this chucklehead at the Atlantic and other people, they don't corrupt our minds from being able to understand what's really the issue.
And to demystify things that are big numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Because when you say $16 trillion debt, well, yeah, if I got a bill for a $16 trillion debt, even I would freak out.
And I'm an economist.
Yeah.
Dang it.
Okay. Well, Pat, take care. I hope you don't get too snowed on tomorrow, and we'll talk soon.
Same with you for Sunday.
Righto.
I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. That was Professor Feiner, the economics professor, wonderful woman. We'll be right back with more of the Rick Smith Show coming right up.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. After an 8-year saga of first winning and then losing collective bargaining rights, graduate student employees at NYU this week won a huge union victory. By an overwhelming pro-union vote of 98%, 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the United Auto Workers Union. NYU is the only private university in America with collective bargaining rights for graduate employees. Matt Canfield says an incredible effort was made for 8 years to sustain the solidarity and cohesion that led to this resounding union win.
It took a
constant education. You know, and it's difficult in graduate employee situations because there's just constant turnover. And so what it really led to is educating so many employees about how to organize. And we did that over the last 8 years. We've just had a wave after wave of really remarkable organizers coming from across the university.
Canfield says NYU's graduate employees were excited about building on this successful union vote.
This has been an eight-year-long struggle with 98% of victory. We are just looking forward to bargaining now. We're excited to get into bargaining negotiations, and we're also looking forward to hearing from our colleagues at other private universities who are starting to call for union representation as well.
The UAW represents more than 45,000 academic workers across the U.S., including graduate employees at the University of Massachusetts, University of Washington, University of California, and California State University. Nearly 800 nurses and healthcare techs locked out at L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut since November 30th say that it's not about money. The healthcare workers are concerned about the well-being of patients as the hospital continues to outsource patient care to non-union locations outside the hospital. Lisa Dabroska is president of the AFT Registered Nurses Local at L&M.
It's about being able to follow our patients and take care of our patients no matter where they are located. We just want to be able to go along and continue to care for our patients like we have been for the last 101 years.
Dabroska says the corporate model, reducing everything to numbers, doesn't work in healthcare.
We are not dealing with numbers. We are not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with patients. And what it seems is the corporation running this hospital is treating the patients like numbers and like widgets. And we just want them to treat the patients like a patient, like a human being.
Patrick Hickey of Madison, Wisconsin's Workers' Rights Center says this year's local Just Dining Guide had two Madison restaurants with perfect scores in how they treat their workers.
Ian's Pizza and Restaurant Muramoto that got perfect scores. What we rank them on are things like starting wage rates for tip to non-tip, access to health insurance, access to paid sick days, access to retirement, access to other kinds of paid time off like vacations and holidays, things like that. These jobs really do need to provide living wage and decent family supporting benefits because our economy needs that. Most of the jobs that are getting created are these service jobs.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center publishes their own national version of a Just Dining Guide at rockunited.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
It is about the children, even after they're born. That was excellent, Brett. We love kids. Even once they're here. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. He's got the night off, getting ready to head off to Florida and spend some time with his family. And that's going to be wonderful. I'm going to be filling in next week, too. Rick will be on Monday night. I'll be here Tuesday and Wednesday night. And then we will be playing encore performances of our trip, our People's Tour for America. And I'll tell you, I'm sure Brett doesn't know which nights are going to have what on, but you just listen to them all. But if you get a chance, some real highlights are when we were in Memphis and we got to talk to the sanitation workers. I mean, the people who Martin Luther King Jr. died to make sure would have a pension plan. Guess what? They still don't have one all these years later. Just really, it was a fascinating trip. It was a lot of fun. And so we're going to re-air a bunch of those shows. We'll all be back here in 2014 to, you know, raise Cain some more, care about kids even after they're born. I want to take a minute, though, and give a tip of the hat to WIOO right here. They really stepped up to the plate for the local Salvation Army. Salvation Army's all across the United States. The worst year that they have had in a long, long time. Press release is incredibly bleak. And the wonderful folks that own this radio station found out about that, got a hold of the local Salvation Army, had Captain Mike Davis in here. They did a radiothon yesterday. They raised over $5,000. They even squeezed $100 out of Rick Smith. Fabulous. So, you know, really just an amazing, wonderful thing. And really, actually, I have to also tip my hat to Rick because when they were getting close but they weren't there, he said, get half of it and I'll give you the other half. People heard that and, you know, kept giving. And so Rick didn't have to give anywhere near as much as he was actually willing to do, which is good because he's taking his family to Florida for the holidays and he probably needs the pocket change. Anyway, one of the things that we want to talk about now, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and just talk about things that are going on in the community. A, that are really positive. You know, I think we, especially when you're on our side of the coin, things look pretty bleak. We just found out that the 99ers are gone. No more 99 weeks of unemployment. If you have lost your job, well, Congress doesn't really care whether or not you can find a new one. You're not going to have unemployment anymore now for more than 25 weeks. And there's some really bleak stories out there, but there are good things happening and exciting things and things that are all about your children. And joining me right now to chat about that is Chad Bruce. He's a local artist and musician. And we're going to talk about his new foundation and a book launch. But real quickly, I just want to say, I was kind of interested in seeing which country publishes the most children's books. Chad, do you want to guess which country publishes the most children's books in the world?
Would it be Austria?
No, it's not Austria, actually. Let's see. Where's Austria on here? Chad actually was born in Austria, which is why he's giving that guess. Austria is 39th. They publish 8,000 children's books, about 8,000 a year.
Ah, well, I'm glad they're on the map somewhere.
Now, it's the United States of America. United States of America published almost 300,000 children's books last year. 292,037. Second most, China, which has like three times as many people. So, and then the United Kingdom coming in third. Chad, tell us a little bit about your children's book you've got coming out.
Well, it's a collaboration. It's I have a background in graphic arts, plus I illustrate as well, and I thought it'd be a fun idea to collaborate with a writer and another artist and collect those skills under one cover and put out a book. So that's what we've done using the skills of people who live in Carlisle.
And, you know, to just be honest, I'm the writer, so I'm a big fan of this book.
Really?
I'm a writer, but Mary Parks, who is an amazing illustrator, tell us about Mary's artwork in this book.
Well, it's a children's book, and she also has, thanks, she also has an illustrative style that's childlike in the sense that the line drawings are simple. They're to the point, and they're very expressive. She does, she captures the essence of what it is she's drawing, in spite of the simple, easy to understand style. And you can oftentimes see her on first Fridays in the summertime on the streets of Carlisle and Pomfret Street doing portraiture. And she does these little caricatures, and we really liked them and thought we would use her as the illustrator for this book.
And it's amazing because she can do five or six little lines of a person's face, and you know exactly who the person is. It's really amazing stuff. So one of the things that this book is going to do, and it really was unfolding daily as we were all working on this book. Like every day we thought of something different to do about this book. And you are a retired graphic artist from Lockheed Martin. So, like, you can draw bombs and missiles and stuff that blows places and things up. And so now you're doing cute little kitty cats and really nice stuff. And it evolved in all this sweetness to you saying, I want to do a children's book every year.
Well, Lockheed Martin is a big money-oriented corporation. I don't think they really care what they sell as long as it keeps the guys in the ivory towers above the clouds. All that aside, every now and then I got to do something creative over there, and it was a good resource because they kept me in updated computer equipment and interesting projects. I'm a musician, and I love to play, and I have to ad lib because I can't read music. And I sort of approach my art in the same way because even though I can draw, a lot of times I won't make a plan. I'll just take the elements of that which have been given to me and just begin working on it unless a plan is absolutely required. But in the case of this book, we sort of made the plan up as we went along, and things evolved. And they look really good. A preliminary copy of this book that we just published, we have in our possession, and I was surprised at how good it looks.
So we have to take our hats off to Dickinson Print Shop, because absolutely everything about this book is local, which is a lot of fun. Mary Parks, Chad Bruce, the graphic artist, I wrote it, and then Dickinson Print Shop printed the thing. And, oh, my God, those guys do incredible work.
I was amazed. Kurt, who runs the place, has, I guess he said he's been doing this for over 20 years, and he does great work. He does everything from brochures and flyers to books and posters and high-end commercial print work. I don't know enough about the advanced digital equipment to give you an impressive list, but looking out into their print shop today, which was the last time I was there, was amazing. They've got some great equipment. But Kurt's a great guy, very personable. He's willing to help, and anytime I had a question, he was right there with the right answer.
And when we were there today, they were hand assembling them because the size of paper we used. So this is a handmade, designed by local artists book, but still a week ago or a month ago, I can't remember anymore because it all sort of blurred in my head with working on this book. You said this is the first book. And so tell a little bit about the plan. This is the first book. It's going to go on sale starting Monday. All the proceeds are going to pay for the next book, blah, blah, blah. But before we get there, your idea for what's going to happen with a book a year? Or?
Well, we'll start out with that book a year idea as a goal. Who knows? If the book is complicated, it might take a year, maybe a little more. If the book is less complicated, fewer words, illustrations that are less complex and easier to colorize, because I plan on colorizing these things and taking a bit of a hand in making the thing look good myself, and I think it's.
Okay, so you're gonna help design the books. Every book's gonna go through this whole new process, but it's not all gonna be designed by Mary. So, what are you looking for? Are you looking for new artists? Are you looking for?
Yeah, Carlisle has lots of artists, and if you don't believe me, check out the many galleries in Carlisle. It's full of local artists, and I think many of them are members of the Carlisle Art Learning Center, and the folks there have art openings all the time. It's full of great local artists. I think many of them would be interested in doing books and helping out with, I think, this great idea. And I'm looking forward to getting in touch with them and asking them. It might be one book a year. It might be two or three books a year. It depends on how complicated we make things and how elaborate the drawings are, how long the stories are. But I'm open to anything. Whatever it takes, I think we should get these books rolling.
Okay, so if you're an artist right now and you're thinking, does this mean me? Yes. It means you. If you're an artist and you're thinking about this and you'd like to be the artist that draws a children's book, Chad is looking for you. You go to the charlesbrucefoundation.org website, Charles Bruce Foundation, know the charlesbrucefoundation.org, and contact Chad through that, because the plan after we did this one particular children's book was, you know, it's coming together. It's so beautiful. We've got this incredible Kurt at Dickinson. It seems like there's nothing we can't do. There's nothing stopping us. Holy cow, the United States of America does almost 300,000 children's books a year, and now we know why. It's at our fingertips, and we can do it. And why shouldn't we? Because little kids need to have wonderful stories, and they need to see beautiful art, and we want them to grow up. We do care about them after they're born, and we want them to grow up to be wonderful, but that missing piece for each annual book is going to be the artist. And so we want you to go and get a hold of the Charles Bruce Foundation. Again, charlesbrucefoundation.org. Sign up. Let us know that you want to be the next the 2014 artist or the 2015 artist. And now we need to find out what the Charles Bruce Foundation is. So the sale of this year's book will pay for the 2014 book. But the initiation of this year's book, the purchase of this year's book, was done by the Charles Bruce Foundation, which you started. Why?
Well, I wanted to sort of give back to the community that which my father inspired me to do. My dad was a colonel in the Army, a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and didn't know a whole lot about art. And I loved art. And he always wanted me to go to school and have some kind of a successful management career or go to work for a large corporation or something. And I nothing could have been farther from my thinking. All I was interested in was art and music. And on the art side, I was drawing all the time, always sketching and painting and doing art projects. And I remember my dad said, do you need a drawing table? I said, yes. He got me a big closet door and put it on two shelves, and that was my big drafting table. And I started doing posters on that. It was I felt special. It was a great gift for me. And when I came back from college, my first year of college, we had been painting wall murals on the walls of the dormitories. So I was really enthused about doing paintings that were larger than life. And we painted some faces on some walls that made the walls look like they were alive. I wanted to do this on something really, really big. And I asked Dad if I could paint a face on the barn roof, and he agreed. He bought me the paint. He threw ropes over the roof, made sure I didn't fall off and I was secure, and let me paint a picture on the barn roof. This was purely an artistic venture, but the next thing I knew, and this was absolutely not planned, was that photographers from the Sentinel came by and started taking pictures of this thing. It got written up in the paper. Aircraft formations from Letterkenny began flying over the farm because, unbeknownst to me, the face on the roof became an aerial landmark, and it appeared on the aerial maps. So apparently the planes fly up the highway and make a left at the face on the barn roof and head over to where they're going. I don't know, but it was fun.
So you've taken that inspiration and that financing. You know, you can't get up on the roof with the ropes if you don't have the paint. So you've taken that and you've decided to start this foundation in your dad's name. All that paperwork is off at the IRS waiting for them to put the old rubber stamp on it. So right now it's still a private foundation. But folks who want to come to the gallery opening of the artwork, there's framed artwork from the book as well as copies of the book will be available this Monday night. Monday the 16th at CALC, the Carlisle Arts Learning Center on Pomfret Street. It's open to the public. The books were expensive to manufacture because they're all made locally, but every single one of them is a handmade piece of art. And it's a cute little story that you can read to your kids. And so the purchase of these books will go right back into the Charles Bruce Foundation to pay for the 2014 book. So folks who want to come and check out the book should come check out the book. Folks who just want to come and wish everybody at CALC and around there a happy holiday are welcome to come. We'd love to meet you. Come by and say hi. We'll have to get a guest book and have people sign it. We'll have a guest book. We'll get folks to just say hello. And then in addition, check out CALC. My God, the stuff at CALC is fantastic. They've got beautiful, what is it?
It's an old firehouse.
Yeah, it's an old contest, but don't they have some sort of holiday sale going on in there, too? An awful lot of the artwork in there is absolutely beautiful and beautifully priced.
Art for the Holidays is the show currently on the walls, and I know that Carrie Bresci, who runs the place, and all the folks there at CALC would love to see everybody come in and find a nice piece of art for under the Christmas tree.
And so we'll have this. That's this Monday night from 5 until 7. And we'd love to see you. We'd love to have you come check out the book. And we'd love to have you meet Mary, the illustrator. She's amazing. She's really wonderful. We've got the opportunity for you. If you are an artist and you think you need to be the person who's doing the 2014 book, we want you to come. Come say hello. Bring your artwork if you want. Write us an email. You can write it to info@charlesbrucefoundation.org. And you can let us know that you're really interested in doing this. And, you know, we have a whole pile of other ideas. I have never done anything that was never is not the right word, but seldom in my career do I get to do anything that was so fun and frivolous. Frivolous meaning, you know, it's not going to feed anybody. It's not going to put a roof over anybody's head. It's not going to stop the dismal reality of the world that my doom and gloom way of looking at things is out there. It's just hopefully going to make some people smile, and people are going to see how beautiful the artwork is that Mary Parks made and that Chad designed and colorized. And it's a luxury. It's a luxury to have that sort of beauty in your life, in my mind, because I work, you know, with poverty and necessities. That said, we want one of these luxury books every single year, but we're also talking about another book, other books, about those necessities. Books that focus on things like homeless children, and books that focus on homeless children are a demographic now. They need their own children's books. You know, that's the cynical, mean old Pat LaMarche talking. And so we've got all these ideas, and we want to meet you if you want to work your ideas in with us. So come on out to Calc. If you can't make it to Calc on Monday night, then info@charlesbrucefoundation.org, or just go to the charlesbrucefoundation.org website, and there's a place where you can fill in the fields. Mary Parks also designed the website, did a great job. Chad, what are other things that you'd like to do with it? This is the arts thing and some writing, and part of the Charles Bruce Foundation is WAM, which is Writers, Artists, and Musicians. You're the other two. I'm the writer, you're the artist and musician. We'll have music at the event on Monday night. You've got about 3 minutes. Tell us a little bit about the local music scene and what you see WAM being able to do for musicians in the area.
Well, I've been a musician for a long time, and I've become familiar and acquainted with a lot of Carlisle's musicians in the music scene here, and I feel that there's so much good music and there's so many good musical opportunities in Carlisle that I just want to see everybody happy. I want to see the clubs have the music that they need, and I want to see the musicians get paid what they're worth. And you know, it's sometimes a cart before the horse kind of thing. You know, we're not going to pay you unless we know you bring in a crowd, that sort of thing. But these things get worked out. In the meantime, I like to promote new talent, young people, and I've contacted a few of them, and I've told them that this is what they will be paid, and I make up the difference between what I think they should make and what the club is willing to pay or can only afford, and I just want to help people along to ensure that there's nobody being discouraged because the price is too low or the price is too high. And if somebody really wants a band in there and they can't afford it, I say, well, just give them what you can afford, and I'll make sure they get the rest. And I work together with a lot of clubs in Carlisle, and I do this, and a lot of bands as well. And it makes me happy to do.
And you help Dickinson, the Bluegrass on the Grass projects and the other things, and you finance a lot of the bluegrass that's down at Mount Holly Inn. So you haven't heard of the Charles Bruce Foundation before because of all the filings with the IRS, and that's finally all done. So you'll be hearing about the Charles Bruce Foundation a lot from here on out. It's exciting. If you have time Monday night, we'd love to see you. If you're a musician, an artist, or a writer, we want to get to know you because, you know, life would be hell without the arts. That's just plain old everyday truth. I'm Pat LaMarche. Thanks for joining us, Chad.
Nice to be here, Pat. Thanks.
I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Red roses too. I'm
about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. After an 8-year saga of first winning and then losing collective bargaining rights, graduate student employees at NYU this week won a huge union victory. By an overwhelming pro-union vote of 98%, 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the United Auto Workers Union. NYU is the only private university in America with collective bargaining rights for graduate employees. Matt Canfield says an incredible effort was made for 8 years to sustain the solidarity and cohesion that led to this resounding union win.
It took a constant education. You know, and it's difficult in graduate employee situations because there's just constant turnover. And so what it really led to is educating so many employees about how to organize. And we did that over the last 8 years. We've just had a wave after wave of really remarkable organizers coming from across the university.
Canfield says NYU's graduate employees are excited about building on this successful union vote.
This has been an 8-year-long struggle with 98% of victory. We are just looking forward to bargaining now. We're excited to get into bargaining negotiations, and we're also looking forward to hearing from our colleagues at other private universities who are starting to call for union representation as well.
The UAW represents more than 45,000 academic workers across the U.S., including graduate employees at the University of Massachusetts, University of Washington, University of California, and California State University. Nearly 800 nurses and healthcare techs locked out at L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut since November 30th say that it's not about money. The healthcare workers are concerned about the well-being of patients as the hospital continues to outsource patient care to non-union locations outside the hospital. Lisa Dabroska is president of the AFT Registered Nurses Local at L&M.
It's about being able to follow our patients and take care of our patients no matter where they are located. We just want to be able to go along and continue to care for our patients like we have been for the last 101 years.
Dabroska says the corporate model, reducing everything to numbers, doesn't work in healthcare.
We are not dealing with numbers. We are not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with patients. And what it seems is the corporation running this hospital is treating the patients like numbers and like widgets. And we just want them to treat the patients like a patient, like a human being.
Patrick Hickey of Madison, Wisconsin's Workers' Rights Center says this year's local Just Dining Guide had two Madison restaurants with perfect scores in how they treat their workers.
Ian Pizza and Restaurant Muramoto that got perfect scores. What we rank them on are things like starting wage rates for tipped and non-tipped, access to health insurance, access to paid sick days, access to retirement, access to other kinds of paid time off like vacations and holidays, things like that. These jobs really do need to provide living wage and decent family supporting benefits because our economy needs that. Most of the jobs that are getting created are these service jobs.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center publishes their own national version of a Just Dining Guide at rockunited.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Mr. President, do you see a major difference between the two of you on Social Security?
You know, I suspect that on Social Security, we've got a somewhat similar position. Social Security is structurally sound. It's going to have to be tweaked the way it was by Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill. But it is the basic structure is sound.
President Obama is just like Mitt Romney. No kidding. Pat LaMarche here. Rick Smith's off for tonight. You know, I'm glad we get to say something nice about the arts and nice people and children's books and all that other stuff I've been doing for fun when I have 5 minutes off from writing the book about the destruction of the middle class by these rats. And now we're back to reality, which is, where did the Democrats go? Now, full disclosure, for those who have not heard my shtick, I was the 2004 vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. So I'm not a Democrat, and I'm sure not a Republican. I left the Democratic Party when the Democratic Party left me. And there's nothing left to the Democratic Party. Someone who may or may not be able to take me out to the woodshed on that is Gaius Publius. You there, Gaius?
I am here. How are you?
Great. What is going on with the Democratic Party? And by the way, first of all, if it has to be a two-party system, do they really want the other party to be Republicans?
Who's to say?
Yeah, I mean, the system is built right now to keep these two parties. The Republicans are so far to the right that, you know, they should be going around in circles like someone nailed one shoe to the ground. And the Dems are just following them to the right.
Well, I will start by saying you're not headed to the woodshed with me, because I'm not going to go there. I am a progressive. I have been pretty much all of my life. I have strong beliefs in things like labor organization and people should get fair wages. So I share all of your values. I share all of the values of, I'm certain, 100% of our listeners tonight. And yet I have nothing but analytical disdain for the Democratic Party, and by analytical, I mean this is grounded in an actual look at what their leadership does. Their mm-hmm. leadership serves the money interest in this country, just like the leadership of the Republican Party serves the money interest in this country, and we can't get love, we, us ordinary people, can't get love from either one of those two groups, and it's smart to be cognizant of that.
I am with you 100%. I never say, if I can help it, the Republicans or the Democrats. I try to say Republican leadership and Democratic leadership, because they have both just hoisted the middle finger at their rank and file.
It's more than the middle finger. They actually play a very good power game. If you look at this budget agreement that we've just gotten through, both the Democrats and the Republicans did exactly what the leadership of both parties wanted them to do. The Tea Party rebels in the Republican Party, for whom I have much operational respect in that they can be extremely helpful to us on some issues, were not able to muster a challenge. And the progressives were not able to muster a challenge in the Democratic Party. That vote was split 332 to 94, as I count it. I may be off by one or two. What that means is, on the Republican side, only 62 no's. Mm-hmm. You should be able to get 90 no's out of the Tea Party on a thing like this. On the Democratic side, only 32 no's. You should be able to get 50 to 60 no's on a thing like this.
Okay, I want to keep going in that direction, but I want to take a tangent for a quick minute. John Boehner's hissy fit that he had the other day, where it was almost like whatever dope they've had him on wore off for 20 minutes, and all of a sudden he realized that they're constantly hamstringing him like every chance they get, where he scolded the far right for castigating him before they even saw the deal. And, I mean, is this all theater, or has he really, and does it matter? First of all, is it all theater? Second of all, does it matter? Is it going to change anything? I mean, this deal screws the poor guy who's on unemployment. It's not that good to the federal worker. You know, it's got a lot of problems that you and I would agree on as problems. So is it just a middle-of-the-road, right-of-center compromise that leaves the flanks out?
Well, those are good questions, Pat. Let's look at this, as you suggest, from the Republican side first, and then I'd love to look at it from the Democratic side separately, because the Democrats played an interesting game as well. On the Republican side, is it theater? Let's start with the idea that there is a real Tea Party rebellion in the country that may be grounded in some racism. Excuse me, we have a change of weather out where I am, and my I seem to be developing a cold.
Oh, I'm sorry.
me too. But the Tea Party rebellion in the country is real. Even if it's grounded in some racism, it's also grounded in a knowledge that the rich are robbing us. When I have retired Air Force people come, for example, and do work with me, they're skilled craftsmen, but they're Tea Party people, I can always make common ground with them when we're talking around the slop bucket for the grout, for example, by saying, what about that bailout? And they hate it. So that's the Tea Party voter. The Tea Party voter is not necessarily the Tea Party office holder.
I was going to say, that's no Ted Cruz.
That's no Ted Cruz. The Tea Party office holder is a fully funded subsidiary of the Koch brothers and people like that through organizations like Americans for Prosperity. So that the day that David Koch wants the Tea Party office holders to take the deal, they will take the deal. They mm-hmm. will swallow their pride and take the deal, or they will not get another dime for another election, mm-hmm. just like all careerists. So I think that the Tea Party folding to Boehner, quote-unquote, may well be theater. It may well be that United Republican Party that includes David Koch and includes all the billionaires that fund the people that like John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, saying it's time to say yes to what's being offered, because what's being offered is really, really sweet.
Well, you know, I think this is the Affordable Care Act, too. You know, I always say it's the insurance company saying, don't throw us in that bag of money. Don't throw us in that bag of money. Don't give us 20 million more customers. No, please, please don't do that. You know what I mean? Sell that Brer Rabbit
stuff.
It's
against my principle.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think I have long believed that John Boehner can't be as big a waste of skin as he seems. And I think that they want busier people than me, right, because I don't do anything but live politics, unfortunately, which you can imagine how dull that makes me. I've been a tomato thrower from the sidelines. I've been in the media for 25 years, and I pay attention to this stuff like a pit bull. And I think people who don't have the time that I have to be watching this stuff think, oh, well, he's been trying really hard to compromise with these guys, and now, wow, he's snapped. I'm just not buying that.
Yeah, there's a kind of a the word is really myth or legend, but that's not quite it. People who are very, very busy, which is most of the country,
mm-hmm.
turn on, let's say, CNN to take a middle-of-the-road kind of station for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, or the local news. And the local news is very good at saying, here's how to think about this. And what they're doing is telling a story. It's like everybody's around the campfire, and Homer, the blind poet, comes in and tells a story. And here's how you think about this. The Trojan War, hell, the Trojans may have won the war. We don't know.
Uh-huh.
But here's how Homer told the story. Here's what everybody believes. And that's what they get out of CNN and their local news every day. That you get the tabloid version of, here's how you think about Mary-Kate Olsen this week. And then everybody moves like a swarm of fish that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, Mary-Kate Olsen is now this other person. The whole swarm of fish moves the other way. And that's the way the country is led. Noam Chomsky calls it manufacturing consent. But it's done on a night-by-night basis, I'm convinced.
Yeah. And that is the job of the media. I remember when I first started out in the media, I started out in television, like all slender young women, and then put on some weight and went straight to radio. But when I first started in TV, I remember one of the photographers, we did A Man on the Street, and he literally edited A Man on the Street so the guy said the opposite of what he said. And it was a big joke. You know, it was a big joke in the newsroom. You know, look at how adept an editor he is. You know, instead of, hello, you know, you just changed that guy's opinion. Misrepresented him.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But that, which was done on, you know, kind of as a yuck, yuck, yuck by a bunch of mid-20 people in their mid-20s who didn't have the responsibility necessary to do a job like that, is done calculatingly to make people feel like we all agree on this thing.
So there's two elements here, and they work in series. That is, one thing happened and then another thing happened. The first thing that happened was in the 20th century, starting relatively early. Most people don't know, for example, that Dorothy Sayers, the mystery writer, started in advertising. She was very, very good as an advertising writer. In the 20th century, the advertising and PR industry got very, very good at manipulating people with images and implications. And it's to the point today where it's down to a science. Mm-hmm. And that's what that's the science that you saw practiced in that story you said.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that happened, starting in the 80s, is that big corporations, a certain number of them, started consolidating big media to the point where big media was really just an arm of major corporations.
Uh-huh.
Right now, you shouldn't think of NBC or MSNBC. You should think of, this is the propaganda arm of General Electric.
Mm-hmm.
This is the propaganda arm of Disney. This is the propaganda arm of, who owns Comcast these days? I don't know. So I can guarantee you that the entertainment industry is allowed to entertain and to rake in all the advertising dollars when it's policy neutral. But when policy matters, like on the news shows, there are rules.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, I mean, just think of it as a trillion dollar corporation has a $1 billion news outlet and it's going to use it to its advantage.
Right. Now,
and those corporations, I mean, they represent the wealth of the country. They are mm-hmm. in league with the Robert Rubens and the David Kochs. They're
right.
in that club. So
right.
that's media.
So, this is stuff that the American people know, if at least only viscerally, right? They know that they're getting fed a line of crap, and they know that they're eating crap, and they know that Monsanto wants it to get crappier, and they know that that they've got, you know, crap for representation, and they know all this. And what they don't seem to know is that it can change. And the one that really gets me going, and I probably am going to need you to help me on this, because I think I have gotten to that beautiful point at 53 years old where I have so much junk in my head that I can't organize it anymore. But
that means you're brilliant.
Okay, I'll go with that, but I'm afraid it might mean the opposite. So, but you know when they figured out that, was it Rupert, that the, basically that, the dude who owned the newspaper in Britain was manipulating the facts and hacking into phone numbers and deceiving people, and they closed down his media empire there. Was that Rupert Murdoch?
That was Rupert Murdoch and News of the World and Times of London, yeah.
Oh, cool. Great. I remembered it correctly. But Rupert Murdoch doesn't get shut down in the United States. In fact,
Rupert gets
stronger. Pardon me?
Oh, Rupert Murdoch has friends. Absolutely.
Right, but
the man's protected.
Why can't we say, well, your friends don't get to make you special rules like they did in the United Kingdom?
I think it's because we don't have control of the political process until we get control of the Democratic Party.
Okay, so that brings us back to the fact. And then it's people like you, I think, who sometimes throw their fist up in the air at people like me, and I still don't want to go to the woodshed with you because I think you're fabulous just from talking to you for 20 minutes. But people say to me all the time, you shouldn't leave the Democratic Party. We're not going to be able to fix it with you people bailing out. And my response is, I'm not going to vote for the people you people are putting up for the possible winners. I mean, if I was a Republican, just to go there for a minute, if I was a Republican looking at that clown car that emptied out on the stage for the Republican debates, you know, with Herman Cain and Ginger White saying the sex was lousy but the money was good, Mitt Romney with his dog on the roof of the car, you know, just buffoon after buffoon. I won't even get into Santorum because we're from Pennsylvania. And then Perry from Texas can't remember what he's talking about. And these are the best and the brightest that the Republican Party has to offer? I couldn't put an R after my name anymore if I was that. But by the same token, the man who promised we'd leave Afghanistan, the one who said, Hillary's telling you she's going to put 40,000 troops more there. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to end these wars. The man who said, you know, we've got to get rid of things like the Patriot Act. The man who said he was going to do something for he was going to have a public option in H.R. 666 and in universal health care was going to be on the table. And He's vanished. So I can't put a D after my name.
Well, you're not going to be able to get to the woodshed with me at all during this segment, apparently, because I'm not going to blame you or the Green Party for 2000.
Thank you, because you can blame Sandra Day O'Connor.
Well, yeah, and failure is an orphan, but in fact, failure is that odd orphan that has many, many parents.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that Al Gore should have asked for a recount of the whole state instead of four counties.
Right, so, and by the way, he won.
So let's look at this from a tactical standpoint, and I think reasonable people with the same principles and the same goals can disagree about tactics and still be reasonable people. The question comes down to, if you want to put into Congress opposition, effective opposition to the neoliberal Democrats who hold the White House, is your fastest route to do that by building Green Party infrastructure and winning a bunch of congressional seats, or is it by running commando raids against a whole bunch of vulnerable Democrats and putting real progressives like Alan Grayson, for example, in those seats? There's a fair number of people like Alan Grayson. We just don't have critical mass yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at those 32 number of no's on the Democratic side. That should have been 60 or 70 or 80.
Mm-hmm.
And then we should have started milking some Tea Party people, really pushing them hard, and build a coalition across the aisle that does for this budget deal what happened with the benefit cuts that Obama and Boehner together kept trying to get benefit cuts. And it was a coalition between the Tea Parties in the House, Tea Party members in the House, and the progressive members in the House that made that an impossible vote for anybody to take. We can do that a lot, but we need to beef up our numbers. So my approach is not to blame third party. It's just to say, look, the Democrats have a party infrastructure already. Let's use it. Let's take over as many places as we can. We don't have to have an alternate party if we commandeer as many Democratic situations.
So my question is, what happens when you've got the guy, and I think the most disappointed person alive in 2009 had to be Hillary Clinton, because she said what she was going to do fairly honestly, and Barack Obama said, there's no way I'd do any of that, I'm going to be far to the left of her, and then as soon as he got elected, he did exactly what Hillary said she would do. So that had to be tough for Hillary, even though I was completely against her centrist or right-wing aspects. But the reason that won't work in my mind and is because even if we get these lefties elected, they don't stay left.
Well, it's an uphill fight, admittedly, and it's not a matter of what will work or what won't work. It's a matter of which combination of actions increases your odds to the greatest extent. And I think that's a decision that we can all make for ourselves and still stay friends.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I think that's because really rational thought would mean we'd all stay friends, right? Because being made into enemies is the plan of the little point at the top of the pyramid that we lay underneath. They
Absolutely.
Want us enemies.
And they want to divide us, and we shouldn't want that for ourselves. We want to stay united. Solidarity.
What state are you in?
I am in Oregon.
Oh, I love Oregon. Well, I here in Pennsylvania, this is just what happens when the Democrats and the Republicans control everything. For one thing, one of the most abysmal things I think about Pennsylvania voting is you can still vote the R ticket or the D ticket. Okay, and people just go in and vote all one party.
Oh, you mean straight party voting?
Right. You don't have to know the name of a person. Or even the number, like in some districts that still cater to the fact that that people may be not literate enough to vote for a person by the spelling of their name. You can just vote R or D. The other thing that is dismal here is they punish people who run for office as a third party. So a U.S. Senate candidate who ran and got, and I'm going to fudge the numbers here because I don't remember them exactly, but he ran and got like 4% of the vote, and the rule was he had to get 7. They fined him tens of thousands of dollars for running and not getting enough votes.
Oh, interesting.
Now,
you're right, and it's the third parties are rigged out of the game in a lot of ways.
And not only rigged out, but severely punished. I mean, in the case of Ralph Nader, he paid the fine, which for him was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. In the case of this U.S. Senate guy, who's just a typical regular old green, which means he rents his apartment and doesn't have any money, you know, all of us are like, woe to anyone who pays $5 of that fine. Mm-hmm. Nobody should be paying that fine. Nobody should. There is no way a person should be punished for having the audacity to try and represent people. And that's the sort of thing where the two major parties are gaming the system so completely that... Not that I would want to cut off my nose to spite my face, and I don't believe I have by being a Green, but even if that were true, how, with a good conscience, could I join a party that would be that ruthless? You know?
Yes, I certainly understand that. This is, to go back to where we started, mm-hmm. at talking about the billionaires, we're in a situation in which we're basically in a pressure cooker,
mm-hmm.
and the lid is being bolted down tighter and tighter,
yeah,
and the fire under us is getting hotter and hotter, and I don't think it's going to be to anybody's advantage. That fire under us, by the way, is naked greed. It's mm-hmm. David Koch, who's worth $36 billion, saying, that's not enough. You have to eat cat food so I can have more.
Right.
That's what's driving this country. That fire is getting hotter and hotter. At some point, something's going to blow, and nobody's going to want to be part of that. I mean, when things get explosive like that, it's no place anybody wants to live. This is just not a good situation.
It makes
me very nervous.
Yeah, we had an economist on earlier, and I have her on every night that I'm on because I just think she's wonderful, and she explains things in a very matter-of-fact, reality-based way. But I was talking to her about the Atlantic article that just came out that infuriated me, which really isn't that easy because I am so used to this. But totally rejecting Catholic, it's shocking that I'm defending any pope, but I love this pope. And he's still not right on women, and he's, you know, but he's so much better. If you're going to talk about dragging somebody back to where they ought to be, this pope has put ropes over both shoulders, and he is pulling that cryptic monarchy, the best I've ever seen in my life, towards what it really should focus on, which is the poor and the tired and the huddled masses, right? So the Atlantic went after him and said, you know, the Pope says that the poor, there are too many poor, and that the greed's ruining the country, but he doesn't use statistics. Thank you.
Oh, jeez, yes. He hasn't upgraded his Outlook account either, has he?
It's got to be the problem. Yeah. So they actually act like he's making it up.
Yeah, this is, well, you know, if the Pope is going to be wrong about some things and right about something, the one thing I want him to be right about is economic justice. Number one, that was the message of Jesus. It really, really was. I'm mm-hmm. a lapsed, what, I won't even say the word, but I'm a lapsed what you were myself. And that's really it. And once you tackle... You take on that burden. You're the Mother Teresa. If the Pope were a political figure in the United States, he'd get himself shot or marginalized.
Well, see, that's what Rick Smith, the guy who I'm filling in for, says all the time. He better make sure he keeps the Pope mobile. The United States has never minded going into other countries to do the shooting or marginalizing. And it's extremely upsetting because this guy has got at least 40 million followers. And his revolution would be peace and love. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you know, he's a forceful, persuasive person. You let him have, so what, John the 23rd had a fairly long reign, and then the guy that followed him had a Paul the something or other, had a short reign, and John Paul II had mm-hmm. a long reign. It's these popes with the long reign, long time in office mm-hmm. that are able to do the drip, drip, drip and mm-hmm. bring both the church and Catholics along with them. If he's Pope for another 15 years, mm-hmm. you're going to see a real cultural revolution,
yeah.
what you might call a greening revolution, to coin a phrase, among worldwide Catholics and American Catholics as well. I think he's going to be a real force for good. And frankly, if you can be right on economics, you can find a way to be right on things like gays and women.
And he's trying. I mean, he talked about the feminine wisdom. They have to respect the feminine wisdom. You know, obviously he's not willing to go far enough to say women priests, but he talks mm-hmm. about the fact that, you know, and I, as an atheist or an agnostic or whatever I am, I don't even have the ability to be that, to have that much commitment that I want to be, say I'm an atheist. I mean, I don't know anything. But so it doesn't matter to me that he says I can get into heaven because I don't think there is one. But the fact that he's like, get off their backs. If they're good people, that's what matters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's focus on the important things. I'm thinking, you know, this guy could create a sea change.
There's a Christian writer whom I'm very, very fond of, John Dominic Crossan, who wrote a book called The Historical Jesus some decades ago, out of which grew an understanding of, yes, there's a historical Jesus, and you can do text analysis to see which of the sayings that were attributed to him are really closer to the time when he actually lived, just by going to the earlier and earlier books.
Huh.
His understanding of the phrase, the kingdom of God, means those who in their heart treat other people today the way God would treat them if he were here.
Wow.
It's not about the future. You have the kingdom of God if you treat people the way God would treat people in your daily life, which is why that beatitude, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God, makes perfect sense. It's a wonderful way to see all of this. There's another way to say this, another beatitude, by the way. Why is it the poor that have the kingdom of God? Because there's nobody under them to abuse for your own benefit. And
yeah.
Don Dominic Crossan's restatement of that is, only the destitute are blameless. No matter how poor you are, if you go to Walmart and buy a $30 pot that should have cost $150, somebody below you has been hurt because you're
right.
getting by.
Only well, you know, and the bottom line, though, the bottom line is this new revised Christianity wants those people to believe the reason they're poor is because they're evil and they're being punished. You know, I'm out of time, but would you come back on next week?
I would love to.
Yeah, I just love chatting with you. You're fabulous. Gaius, it's been a treat.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Wonderful.
And good luck to all of you and all of your listeners.
Wonderful. We'll have Gaius back on next week, either Tuesday or Wednesday night of next week. I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. After an 8-year saga of first winning and then losing collective bargaining rights, graduate student employees at NYU this week won a huge union victory. By an overwhelming pro-union vote of 98%, 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the United Auto Workers Union. NYU is the only private university in America with collective bargaining rights for graduate employees. Matt Canfield says an incredible effort was made for 8 years to sustain the solidarity and cohesion that led to this resounding union win.
It took a constant education. You know, and it's difficult in graduate employee situations because there's just constant turnover. And so what it really led to is educating so many employees about how to organize. And we did that over the last 8 years. We've just had a wave after wave of really remarkable organizers coming from across the university.
Canfield says NYU's graduate employees are excited about building on this successful union vote.
This has been an 8-year-long struggle with 98% of victory. We are
they're just looking forward to bargaining now. We're excited to get into bargaining negotiations, and we're also looking forward to hearing from our colleagues at other private universities who are starting to call for union representation as well.
The UAW represents more than 45,000 academic workers across the U.S., including graduate employees at the University of Massachusetts, University of Washington, University of California, and California State University. Nearly 800 nurses and healthcare techs locked out at L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut since November 30th say that it's not about money. The healthcare workers are concerned about the well-being of patients as the hospital continues to outsource patient care to non-union locations outside the hospital. Lisa Dabroska is president of the AFT Registered Nurses Local at L&M.
It's about being able to follow our patients and take care of our patients no matter where they are located. We just want to be able to go along and continue to care for our patients like we have been for the last 101 years.
Dabroska says the corporate model, reducing everything to numbers, doesn't work in healthcare.
We are not dealing with numbers. We are not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with patients. And what it seems is the corporation running this hospital is treating the patients like numbers and like widgets. And we just want them to treat the patients like a patient, like a human being.
Patrick Hickey of Madison, Wisconsin's Workers' Rights Center says this year's local Just Dining Guide had two Madison restaurants with perfect scores in how they treat their workers.
Ian's Pizza and Restaurant Muramoto that got perfect scores. What we rank them on are things like starting wage rates for tip to non-tip, access to health insurance, access to paid sick days, access to retirement, access to other kinds of paid time off like vacations and holidays, things like that. These jobs really do need to provide living wage and decent family supporting benefits because our economy needs that. Most of the jobs that are getting created are these service jobs.
The Restaurant Opportunities Center publishes their own national version of a Just Dining Guide at rockunited.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick Smith. Rick is taking the night off, getting ready. Carolyn in here getting ready to take the kids and head to Florida for the holidays. And Ellen Ratner's with me right now from Talk Radio News. Hey, Ellen, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm getting a little worried about the country. Like, it's very violent right now. Another school shooting?
Well, another school shooting today, that's right. The killer looks like he killed himself, but there was somebody that tried to stop him pretty seriously injured, as I understand, another person. That's all we've heard about at this point. It may be more, but I don't think so. And so, yes, that's happening. At the same time, of course, there was something that went on at the Wichita Airport, and there was a plot by a 58-year-old man to really go after and blow something up, and he thought he had explosives on his truck that he was driving. Well, of course, they had ferreted out the plot before, and so these explosives were not really explosives, and as he tried to drive the truck, they were.
Now, Ellen, I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on, you know, because I do represent a large faction of the country that thinks there's a conspiracy behind every woodshed. But, you know, I get a little frustrated with these stories of the guys who say something like, oh, I want to do a jihad, blah, blah, blah. And then the next thing you know, there's an FBI agent talking to him on the internet. And then the FBI agent saying, oh, I can get you the stuff. And then the FBI agent's giving him fake stuff. And it sounds like they take a guy who, you know, probably
is trapped in them?
Yeah, I mean, probably unstable, but it.
They probably do.
Yeah, and I guess
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, you know,
on the other hand, the FBI called you up and said, "Hey, you know, I got these explosives. Let's blow up an airport." I don't think you buy it.
No, I also, though, wouldn't say, hey, I want to do a jihad, except now I've said it twice on the radio, and I'll probably get locked up on my way home tonight.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've got to be careful about what I say, because Lord knows, who knows what clip the NSA has been listening to, just that those three words or what? Okay, so, yeah, that was pretty dramatic, and tomorrow is the Sandy Hook anniversary.
That's right, and so there's a lot going on. Terms of all of that.
Are we going to get gun control because of this?
Am I what?
Are we going to get gun control because of this now?
Well, no, we're not going to get gun control because people in the NRA and other places are actually saying that we're misguided, that gun safety among children has actually gone down in terms of incidents, and more guns have been sold. Give me a break.
Yeah, really. Yeah, the new ads that are coming out, have you seen those hosted or featuring the parents of the children who were murdered last year?
Talking. No, I did not see that. What did they say?
Oh, my gosh. There have three of them up right now. I think I saw it on MSNBC, but maybe it was Huffington. They have these one-minute ads with the parents of the children, and they show the children's pictures, and they say, you know, my little boy was the kind of little boy that would take an aunt outside so that they could be back with their family or take worms off of the... this is the one that, you know, really stuck in my throat when I was watching it. Take the worms off the sidewalk so that they wouldn't die in the sun. My son died, you know, a year ago today or whatever. And these will be running this weekend. Just incredible.
Amazing. Well, I think, you know, they honestly need to run. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's going to change anything. If Sandy Hook did not change that in this country, I'm not sure anything.
Yeah, no kidding. 20 little tiny children. Okay, so budget. We've got a budget. Even the Wall Street Journal says it's the least bad budget. And now if the Wall Street Journal doesn't like your budget.
Well, that's exactly right. The budget issue, though, looks like it has 55 Democrats. 4 Republicans are going to vote for it, including John McCain and Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, Mr. Burr. And there are 3 that are sitting on the fence, including, it looks like, perhaps Lisa Murkowski and perhaps John Hogan.
I hear that the new budget really had both Paul Ryan and President Obama gunning for federal workers again until it got toned down a little. You know, haven't the federal workers had enough taking it on the chin in the last year?
Well, I think that, yes, and unfortunately, this budget is going to affect some newer retirees or some new employees and their retirement, so that's certainly going to be a part of it. On the other hand, they've been paying, at least the Fed, you know, with the military, if you do 20 years in the military, you get a full retirement. I mean, that means some people are retiring at 40, 42. Maybe they could raise that retirement a little bit. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. Plus, they'd also be employed.
Right. Except they'd be employed in the job that might get you killed. But at the rate we're going in this country, that could be any job.
Right. And particularly if OSHA doesn't do its job.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, I have been really intrigued by these stories about the FBI, CIA agents. The CIA now paying millions and millions of dollars to his family that are actually our dollars, right?
Right, exactly. So basically today, Jay Carney at the White House went off on the AP for publishing the story, said that it was irresponsible of them to publish the story, but no one has done anything about this, D.C.
How did it all happen? I mean, the guy, everybody knew for 6 years that he was a plant, and a spy, and just like everybody's kicking the can around the office and nobody's telling anybody?
That's right, really. Apparently no one was revealing what was really going on with it. I mean, we're doing all these covert operations. Well, just like if you and I write something on the internet in an email, we can't expect it to be private. How can anybody now expect that anything the government does is private?
Right. Right, yeah. It's kind of, it reminds me a little bit, the only story I can think of that it really reminds me of is when they shot down the U-2 pilot. Was that Gary Powers?
Gary Powers. We were just talking about him at dinner because I don't know if you realize this. My partner was a U-2 pilot.
No, really?
Yeah,
that something?
She's the second woman to fly the U-2 spy plane.
Wow. I bet she's an exciting person to talk to. So
she's in medical school.
You know those overachievers, Ellen?
Right.
I'm really excited when I get like everything done and bathed in the same day.
It is amazing.
Those are my victories. Yeah. So that's what this reminds me of, though, is this whole oh no, we didn't have a spy there. Oh, oops, you caught one. So is this blow
right.
us out of the...
I mean,
we shouldn't have any credibility anyway on whether or not we're
fine. And we didn't do anything. They say, well, his life could be endangered. Well, I think after 7 years, we would have heard something.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible.
If he was still alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Right, right. Absolutely. Although, I forget, Tom Robbins or somebody wrote that book about the different people from Vietnam and other places, other eras, that hid when they were stationed somewhere and didn't want to be found just because they didn't want to come back. And that, of course, is something that nobody ever wants to consider, that everybody wouldn't be like, rah, rah, I want to get back to the United States at all cost. You know, but his book was sort of like, well, you know, maybe I kind of like it here and these people aren't so bad and I guess I'll just stay. And that concept, mind-blowing back in the Vietnam era and then after it too, I guess. Why is ISA, is that how I say his name, ISA's committee, why is he after the administration? What, did I miss that?
Well, I think that he's just been, it's been very constant for him and he wants to, he doesn't like what they did with health care. And he's just going to go after them, no matter what.
What they did with healthcare, you mean by not having the website up?
Right.
You know,
and
I couldn't download Jon Stewart last night.
They got sold a bill of goods, and that's what he feels.
Oh, for the love of God.
I mean, that's truly what he feels. So you're not going to change.
Yeah, this is just a partisan attack, maybe?
Well, yes, it's a very partisan attack. And he's now... trying to subpoena records from the federal government. The federal government says you just leak everything to the press, and we're not going to do it. So the government will he's going to subpoena the government, and the government will most likely try and the president. And my guess is that he'll declare executive privilege, like that's been declared by every president since.
Yeah,
Nixon, really.
Yeah, I was going to say 43 used it plenty.
Right.
For just about everything from attorney general stuff to right on through. Not that I'm okay with any of it. I'd like a little more transparency in my government, but Lord knows that would still be pretty opaque. It does seem...
A little more transparency would not be difficult, but they don't seem willing to do it.
Right.
Including even have photographers take pictures of the president on Air Force One.
But they did get a picture of him shaking hands with Raul Castro, which went everywhere, I suppose. You know, this is just an aside, but I qualify for that, poor people. I don't have any money and I don't have any health care. And, you know, come January 1st, I'm going to have to start thinking about changing that, I guess. But I went to a clinic because I didn't feel well, and I went to get my prescription filled, and it was $79 for this antibiotic because I was so sick, and you have to have those new powerful ones, the nuclear bomb antibiotics.
Right.
And because of the Affordable Care Act, I could sign up on this club like rich insurance companies have, and my antibiotic went from 79 to 39 because of the 15% maximum profit.
Wow.
I know. They were making another $40 before. And then I just, you know, because the kind of line of work I'm in, I went home and I looked it up, and they made like $89 billion last year, the drug companies, and something like 15,000 people died without their medicine. And I'm thinking, how can you really attack anything that just made literally the medicine I needed desperately actually affordable with somebody still making a profit? It was ridiculous.
Well, I mean, that's why the drug companies make such a huge profit. Mm. Now they're saying, well, we need that money so they can put it back into research. But do they, or do they just put it in the pockets of executives and that kind?
Yeah, no, and the federal government funds their research. Then they turn around and come back.
Well, not
to the
all of
government.
It. No.
Yeah, I know, but
a lot of drugs are done at the NIH with small sort of research grants, and then very often drug companies will take over promising drugs. It does. Mm. It should be because of our crazy regulations. It can take $1 billion sometimes to bring a drug to market.
Yeah, and then they make.
It can be very expensive. However, they still make at least 18%.
Yeah, this was a brand new antibiotic, though, too, that they were still making 15% of with me paying 39 instead of 79. Okay, so my last question, because I'm absolutely fascinated. First of all, Kim Jong-un's uncle, who just was executed for, among other charges, using drugs and womanizing, which, with the exception of President Obama, would have been every president for the past.
Doing, however,
pardon me?
Is that he, it sounds like, from what I understand, mm-hmm. that he introduced Kim Jong-un to his wife and then went after the woman that he introduced him. Not a smart move if the guy's president and dictator for life.
Right. Is it a sign that Kim Jong-un's power is not solidified under him? Because that was one of the things that
were
comparing
it to. Well, a lot of people are saying that's exactly what's the problem, is that he's going to have a very hard time getting all of this guy that they executed people out.
Huh. Because this is sort of a Stalin tactic. Anyone who might have a little bit of power, I'm going to take out in my wake. Which wasn't
right.
really a North Korean tactic for the last 50 years or so that I read of. This is more what his grandfather would do, not what his dad was doing.
I understand, but yeah. We're just learning some of the factoids now.
And
I think it's going to be a little while, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody doesn't get a picture on the Internet of how he died.
And you said that he died in a really gruesome fashion.
Well, I just heard tonight at a dinner party I was at, of some people from Asia that they put him in with hungry dogs.
Oh, my
and
God.
And he hadn't eaten in 3 days or something, and then they tore into him.
That is amazingly unconscionable.
Unconscionable, absolutely.
Wow. That just strikes of something that you wouldn't even imagine happening nowadays.
But it does.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, Ellen, on that happy note.
on that pleasant note,
yeah,
you have
so,
a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Have you and your medical student partner got great plans for the weekend?
She's stunning.
Oh, I bet
and
she
is. I'm working. I'm actually going to be on Fox tomorrow morning talking about Goats for the Old Goat, which is our charity.
Oh, that's wonderful. And can people tune in? What time?
8:30 Eastern.
8:30 Eastern.
Goats for the Old Goat.
Goats
that's
for the Old
right.
And that's for your African charity to feed villages
feed
and
people who sometimes eat every other day. That's right.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, Ellen, break a leg tomorrow morning.
Thank you so much.
All right. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News. I'll be right back. This is Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be back in just a minute.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, 24 is the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him, told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will till, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American.
888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick. He's got the night off. We're going to talk to David in Iowa. Hey, David, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, thanks for taking me. I was listening. I figured I'd chime in and say hello.
Wonderful. Is there anything in particular that raises your ire or makes you happy?
Well, I'll tell you what raises my ire. It's something that you were talking about before. That the liberals go to Washington, D.C. as liberals, but then they kind of change their tone. And the thing is that we have so many people in the Democratic Party who think the Clintons are like the ultimate progressive couple. And, you know, stained glass, they supported NAFTA, they did all this stuff, and yet there's these great liberals. And I was talking to one Democrat activist here who had this idea that we need to support the lesser of the two evils to get ahead. It's just like, so you would support someone who's going to beat you slowly versus someone who's going to beat you in a hurry. You know, like the Democrats will give you a little something with one hand, but hurt you with the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, you just don't understand politics. I'm like, no, I have a degree in political science. I've been doing this since the 80s. I think I have a pretty good notion about what's going on with the political process.
You know, it's always going to be that way as long as the people of the United States believe that it's the best they can do. It's the same thing with, like, you know, shopping at Walmart. You know, Walmart destroyed all the small businesses, and now you don't have a choice. And so people are like, I don't have a choice. I guess start your own small business, you know? So that's what political parties have done. They've started their own small political parties. That doesn't mean that they're going to be instantly successful. And trust me, Walmart doesn't want a small business competing with them. But the other aspect is, I mean, New Hampshire is an interesting state. New Hampshire has a profit tax. They don't tax your corporate income. They tax your corporate profit. Guess what? Very few Walmarts. Because they don't want to be lowering their profit to save on taxes. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but as a person who would support another way, a different way from going Democrat or Republican, they say we're just going to keep getting these idiots in office, and you just better get used to having a lesser idiot.
Yeah. I got smart because there's that, and I won't say the whole thing, but you ever watch the movie Risky Business?
Mm-hmm.
You remember that famous saying that even as his father said at the end, but a little bit less, you know, I really can't say it on the radio. Sometimes you just have to say that, you know.
So we'll let that be the last word because that's the music playing. Rent Risky Business and see the end of it. David in Iowa, thanks for your call. I'm Pat. Rick will be back on Monday.
To the Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like